Hey everyone, welcome to What Are You Watching? I'm Alex Withrow and I'm joined by my best man, Nick Dostal. How you doing there, King Benny?
Don't do it. Oh, okay.
I wasn't. No. I'm not going to go that dark.
I was
dark.
Like, what are you going to do?
No. How you doing there, King Benny?
I can't do a fucking accent. My Hell's Kitchen.
Well,
accent.
His is hard.
Well, yeah.
His is hard because he's like Italian. You know, I love, you know more than one Danny Snyder? No, King Benny. Bring me the one you know. I love
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
He's so like matter of fact to the point. All right, sleepers. Here we go.
Oh.
This is one of my all time favorite coming of age films. One of my favorite movies about trauma, revenge, sweet lasting revenge. I think it is a perfect 90s movie with the cast, the rich cinematography that never calls attention to itself. Like,
yeah.
The movie opens with this like brilliant Warner crane shot. Like, they're all on the roof and it goes down to the street. And like, no one ever talks about that. Like, no one ever talks about how actually well made the movie is. The whole time I was rewatching this movie for this episode, I'm like, I mean, it was a hit when it was released, but like no one really talks about it that much anymore. And we're going to get into all this, but this is a movie I watch. This is one of the movies I've seen the most. I watch it annually, at least once annually. And this movie contains one of the most ice cold movie characters I've ever seen on film. One of the worst villains just ever. It's a solid courtroom thriller. And this movie pulls off something that's really hard to do. It convinces us that some motherfuckers deserve to die. How are you feeling today?
Wow. That's I was about to use the word cool. But I mean, well, that's a very true take, man. Like, you do feel like that. Like, this it actually makes me wonder if this movie would work today. For that reason,
yeah,
where there is like this gray area of what we're rooting for as an audience, which is in the general sense of like human justice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you really feel that strongly about something when someone is so evil? I'm feeling good about it, man. I'm feeling good.
One thing I know for sure, I usually save like how well the movie did at the end if this movie was somehow made today with the same caliber of cast, because this movie was sold on the cast.
Holy
the
shit.
The cast still plays as a holy shit cast. Like,
yeah.
And we're decades later and this cast still hits. At the time, it was like, how the hell did they do this? How did they get all these people in one movie? So this movie cost $44 million, went on to make $165 million.
That's
hard
crazy.
R 2.5 hour movie that came out in October, did not really have Oscar prospects, but it was made by a Hollywood veteran filmmaker, Barry Levinson. He has an Oscar for Rain Man. It stars so many Oscar nominees, Oscar winners, but then it also has this young emerging cast who would all grow to be famous. Some of the boys who were playing the boys, some of them grew up to be famous. So what I want to know is, like, when did you first come of age for Sleepers? When did you first hear about it? I'm like, this is one of the reasons why we're doing this. I rented this the day it was released on VHS. The Tuesday is released. I'm 11 years old. I had heard about it because it actually came out right around my brother's birthday, and my dad took him to go see it in the theater. I was still probably a little too young for subject material like this to be taken to the theater.
Yeah.
They both saw it, they liked it, and this is a family I grew up in. Like, I'm having serious conversations with my dad about Sleepers at age 11, but I was ready for this one. What about you, though?
So I remember this movie like in 96 being a thing, but I really wasn't tackling movies like this then. So to me, it was always, I had like, it's so funny, I had a stigma about movies like this at a young age, being like, oh, this is one of those like good movies. This is one of those like
prestige.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think I really cared for that at that time. Cause I was like, yeah, how old were we? Like 10, 11. So
11. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just remember seeing the cover in a Blockbuster, like, cause me and my uncle would go and we'd rent videos. I remember always this cover of like that dark kind of like muted gold kind of coloring, and then the list of the cast.
Yeah, Bacon, De Niro, Hoffman.
Yup.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah, it's great.
And I just remember looking and go, ugh, this movie. We're not renting this. We're not renting this. And so around when I was in college, I was told by basically everyone that I was the Kevin Bacon of the theater department. That was the actor that I
not
got.
Like, okay, like the Kevin Bacon, but not the Sean Noakes, right?
No,
like
no. The actor Kevin
got a
Bacon.
What kind of theater apartment you have going on?
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Okay. Hey, that's and, I dig that compliment. I've always loved
Kevin
Bacon.
Bacon's
We're
amazing.
Gonna get to him today. Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, okay, all right, everyone, let's all calm down. If you're all calling me the Kevin Bacon of the theater department, then like I better, because I knew Tremors. I knew some
Footloose.
Of his. Yeah. Well, actually, no, I never even saw Footloose then. So I've seen it
Footloose.
Since. But I wasn't really that familiar with much of Kevin Bacon's stuff. And so I went to my professor and I was like, all right, so you've dubbed me this name. I'm the Kevin Bacon of the theater department. So what's a good Kevin Bacon performance I should see? And he said Sleepers. And he didn't prepare me for it or anything. He just just goes Sleepers. And I was like, okay, all right, I'll watch it. So went home, watched it, had no idea what I was getting myself into. It was like, on one hand, you're kind of enthralled by this whole entire movie. And then you get a performance like that. And it just shakes you. Like, you're like, how am I even supposed to kind of like feel about now that I'm being called the Kevin Bacon of the theater department?
Well, that's what I mean. That's why I wanted the clarification. If it was because of this, hey, good on the professor for recommending this and not like teasing it out, being like, oh, you want a Kevin Bacon performance? Like, this guy can do more than, you know, cut loose on a dance floor and, you know, kill giant snakes in the desert.
There it is.
Are they snakes? Are they called tremors? Or are the tremors like what they... That's like the earthquake, right? They call them like bugs?
Yeah, I don't know. I remember what they call them.
Like giant worms or bugs?
Because he was also only in Tremors. Was he in
the first two?
Was he in one and two? Just one, yeah.
Just one. Just one, yeah. Fred Ward was in them all, I think. I think there was like six. I don't know. Fred. All right, I love that. I love that. Yeah, what an introduction. There are a few things we're going to breeze by today as we go. They are a huge part of the Sleepers lore. I don't have any concrete information about it. I'm referring to the book the film is based on, because after I saw the movie and became obsessed with the movie and loved the movie really taught me a lot. I finally bought the book. I read the book. The book is written by Lorenzo Carcaterra. Sorry if I'm not saying that right. That is who Jason Patrick's character is based on. He's based on a version of Lorenzo. And as a literary text, the book to me is superb. If you like the movie, you will like the book. Now, as a work of nonfiction, which the book purports to be, I just can't speak to that. We're not really going to explore that on the pod, so I just want to get all of this out of the way right now. And I'm quickly going to go through the book, the pre-production, because they used to do this in Hollywood. This doesn't happen anymore. This is nuts. Sleepers is the exact kind of mid-budget, you know, $40 to $50 million movie that we can play and doesn't exist anymore. It costs $44 million to make. It stars a ton of A-listers. It's directed by an Oscar winner. It's scored by the most famous movie musician ever. It's shot by the guy who shot Goodfellas. So the movie comes together quickly. Lorenzo submits his book to a publisher, a smaller movie company house called Propaganda Films, which was co-founded by David Fincher. They buy the movie rights to the book in February 1995. Barry Levinson comes on to direct. Everyone is cast by July. They're filming in August 95. They film for a few months, edit the picture, and Warner Brothers distributes it wide in mid-October 1996. That is very fast for Hollywood. So while all this is going on, while pre-production and filming is going on, Lorenzo is claiming that his book is based on a true story and that the events in the book happened to himself and his friends in Hell's Kitchen when they were younger. That whole notion is coming under very heavy scrutiny. Everyone's involved. The Catholic school Lorenzo attended calls bullshit. The Manhattan DA gets involved. They call bullshit. They say no case like this has ever existed. Lorenzo maintains his story. Levinson said he believes the author and went ahead to make the movie. Is Sleepers, the book and movie, an exact representation of what this Lorenzo writer went through when he was 13? I don't know, but I do know that stories like this do happen. So that's all I can say on it. That's it, you know?
So obviously the judicial part of the, I'm assuming, book and movie is fictional.
Well, yeah, sure, because you would, that's why the Manhattan DA got involved, because they're like, we have no cases of this, like, ever taking place, of, like, you guys with, like, a cart, like, doing some sort of cart thing, and then getting two guys off of, like, you know, prison for killing a guard. So they're saying this doesn't exist. I do want to bring this up because I kind of need to call myself out here, because I've said so many times on this podcast that I hate when movies say based on a true story and then they're not. I guess why I don't have that big of a stain against this, because I didn't know any of this was based on a true story. Like, when I saw all this stuff, that was not a selling point of the movie for me because I was so young, but I guess it was part of the marketing. So I don't know. I've never been a fan of people doing this, of people saying that something's true and it's not, but I don't care. Like, this was from, book was like 95, 96. The movie means so much to me. So if it didn't happen, okay. But I stories like this do happen. So that's enough for me. That's enough, you know?
Oh no, for sure. Like, I mean, the unfortunate reality of the abuse that happens that's reflected in this movie is very true. I was just thinking about, like, the case, mm-hmm, like, coming together the way where this one boy actually became a lawyer, this case got dropped in his lap, and they did all of this, like, complete smoke and mirrors type thing. Because that, to me, in a great way for the movie, feels like what a 90s, even, like, something like The Verdict or, like, Injustice for All, like, that courtroom drama that's over the top and not exactly realistic, but you buy it because you go along for the ride.
Yeah, I mean, A Few Good Men has nothing about those courtroom scenes are believable, but they're fun. If we're gonna, like, litigate the court, like, the accuracy of the courtroom stuff, there's a whole host of things that, like, calling in a character witness, if it was going that poorly, you'd be like, hey, Your Honor, we need to pause here. Leave. Like, we need, I guess I called the wrong character witness. So it'll be like, we're about 15 minutes in. So we're going to do something a little different. Oh, God. We're going to do something a little different. We're going to slow things down before we really get going about the movie. Before we really get going, we're going to get a little personal, which I've done a few times on the podcast. And I've always done it with a greater amount of resistance because I want people to listen to our podcast and hear two knucklehead best friends talking about movies. That's all this should be. It should just be fun. I want us to have fun doing it. I want the people to have fun listening to it. But since you are listening, occasionally, we talk about movies that transcend the art form for me. Sleepers, He Got Game, Antoine Fisher, which I brought up a few times. These are just movies to most people, if people have even seen them, but these movies changed my life. I found these films at points in my life when I absolutely needed them. The perspective I gained from Sleepers allowed me to live my life in a fuller way. If I'm going to do a podcast about Sleepers and make grand declarative statements like Sleepers is the most emotionally important film I will ever see, that's not going to make sense unless I paint a fuller picture. So I talk about my brother a bit on this podcast, a bit more than I thought I would. I did not realize that was going to happen. And I do this again with resistance because I don't want to sound like a broken record or keep constantly bringing these, you know, things up. But my brother was not a mentally well person, and, you know, who knows why? Family history, chemical imbalance, childhood trauma, all the above. Who the hell knows? And he was not a pleasant person. He was angry, explosive, irrational, paranoid. He would do things that did not make sense if you challenged him on anything. He would get angry. That behavior was always there. He was 3 years older than me, and from when I was born, that was always him. When I got much older, I started going to therapy, and I started to study things like bipolar 1 disorder, borderline personality disorder, paranoid schizophrenia. And through that, I was finally able to identify my brother's behavior. But by then, I'm off of college. I had purposefully become estranged from my brother. I didn't have any of that psychological perspective when I was actually living with him when we were young. But thankfully, I discovered a few key movies, like the one we're talking about today, that helped. Because things got way, way worse with my brother. While he was already exhibiting combative behavior at a young age, when he was 12 years old, he was physically assaulted by a grown man that he thought he could trust. And that one single event was the turning point. I want to be clear here, very, very, very clear. I am not saying that this single event, quote unquote, made my brother mentally ill. It was already there. He was already strange. He was already angry. But this single event did turn a strange and angry child into a tortured, violent monster. Overnight, my brother went from doing well in school and playing in a ton of organized sports to isolating himself and violently challenging anyone who stood up to him. He could spin into a rage, the likes of which I have never seen matched by another person in real life or on screen. I see things like Edward Norton in American History X at the dinner table. That gets kind of close. We're like everything, you know, we're having a nice discussion. And then within 4 minutes, he spun himself completely out of control. Whew, that gets close. A few years after this event, when my brother was a teenager, a bad group of friends, of which he was the leader of, and you start to mix in drugs and alcohol, and it just made all of this so much worse. To his friends and his girlfriends, he was the tough guy. He didn't take shit from anyone. He was the crazy guy who was in all of their corners. He would punch a teacher or curse out a cop, and that was probably exciting to his friends. But at home, at night, with just myself and my parents, it was like the anger had nowhere else to go, so it exploded. Often, quite often, I was the recipient of the violence, emotionally or physically. Other times, I just barricaded myself in my room and watched movies. And routinely, in his most explosive moments, I would hear my brother cry out the man's name who brutalized him.
Oh.
I would hear him go back to this event over and over and use it as a crutch, use it as an excuse for why he was the way he was. I saw him actively avoid any repercussions for his own behavior because of what he had been through. And initially, I was 9 years old. I felt terrible for him. But after a few years of him constantly taking his rage out on me and my parents, who were innocent, I realize that we've all been through something bad or traumatic or horrific. We all have baggage. And if you keep using that as an excuse to not explore your own mental health, then it could very well kill you. I have never seen any of this, all this stuff that I'm describing, portrayed with more honesty than in Barry Levinson's Sleepers. In this film, four boys survive horrific abuse from men who were hired to guard them. And they do survive it. They do make it out of that dark, cold basement, but they are forever altered. As you're going to hear, one is doing, he's okay. He works at a paper. He gets by. The other one is a lunatic, but he's not psychotic. He's just spent seemingly his entire adult life manipulating the legal system to bury the four guards who tortured him. And those other two boys have grown into full-fledged psychopaths. They are not sociopaths. They cannot hide it. They cannot blend into society. They walk into a bar and you immediately know they're trouble. And when they get a chance to kill one of those guards, they do not spend years thinking about how to legally bury him. They just shoot him 8 times in a New York restaurant. I saw Sleepers for the first time 18 months after my brother's attack, when he seemed to be well on his way to turning into the adult John or Tom from Sleepers. And Sleepers, I cannot tell you how much this movie helped me understand. It helped me compartmentalize. It helped me survive. Good Will Hunting came out the next year. It did too. That film made me realize it. Yeah, the horrible shit we've gone through is not our fault. But it is our responsibility to deal with it. Will Hunting has never left Boston. He has no capacity for love. By the end of that movie, because of what he's opened himself up to emotionally, he's uprooting his entire life for the sake of love. I got that. I got that. He Got Game did this as well. I got way too nervous on that episode to bring up everything that I'm talking about now. And while Jake and Jesus in that movie are father and son, that relationship is my brother and I. That combative, antagonistic, aggressive behavior, the little boy trying to stand up to it, the innocent bystanders who get hurt. And then years later, the aggressor wants solace, but the abused little boy wants none of it, just as I did. My brother apologized to me twice in my life, and they were real apologies with tears. Both of these apologies happened in the same summer, the summer before I left for college. One apology happened after we watched He Got Game together. The other, much more emotional apology happened after we watched Sleepers together. And he did mean what he said to me, but it was too little too late for me. That was 2004. He died in 2016. We saw each other a handful of times in those years. I never had a cell phone number or email address. The last time I saw him was 2013. And to his credit, he did seem to get his life together for a little bit. He had a good job. He made good money. He got master's degrees, plural. Got along really well with my parents, which I could not believe. His life was never perfect, but he did seem to be getting on. And then in a snap, he had a complete and utter mental breakdown. There was no event that led to this. He woke up one morning and was quite simply out of his mind. Tom Wilkinson, Michael Clayton. And he stayed that way for a little over a year until he died by suicide. It's a long story. Sleepers, important movie. I do think I needed to say this because I didn't want to tiptoe around my brother during this episode. I was extremely nervous to mention all this, but if you want to know why I'm so obsessed with certain movies and films like Sleepers in particular, this is why. When I was not the target of my brother's rage, I was hiding in my room watching movies, usually desperately trying to find movies that showed the darker sides of human nature so that I could understand my life better. And, you know my dad is listening. I just want to say that I love him. And this is why he's my best friend, because we made it, you know, we're here. The day my brother died, the day he died, my dad told himself that he would not let the death of his oldest son define who he was. And he hasn't. I hope this is all okay. I hope, I don't get personal for sympathy. Believe me, that is not my intention, but we're not defined by the worst thing that happened to us. We're not. At the end of this movie, there's a passage, I can hear my voice cracking, that has meant so much to me. When Brad Pitt and Jason Patrick are talking after the court, and Jason Patrick says, "Don't go too far. I may need a good lawyer someday. You can't afford a good lawyer. May need a good friend, though." Brad Pitt says, "I'll find you when you do. Count on it." That's it. What do we do now with the rest of the podcast? What the hell was I thinking? Yeah, I know. Thank you. Thank you for being here and being a very, you know, warm presence as I said all that. You know that story. This isn't something I talk about a lot, but there's a whole, like, there is a picture to paint here. It's not a necessarily pleasant one, but this movie, this movie just helped me in ways I have just tried to articulate, but really will never be able to fully. So that's it. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, man. I mean, obviously I know that story. I mean, I think the first time I actually learned that about you, I read it. It's something that you've put into a piece of your art.
Yeah, in my script.
And that I remember being like, oh, I didn't know any of this. I think it's really, really beautiful and brave that you put that out there in this forum. Because this isn't just, it's not you just putting out a diary entry, just like, oh, hey, people, listen. There's a point. And this is, like I've always said, this is why we've started this podcast, was because.
This is why, yeah.
There are movies that help us either understand our lives or help reflect, mirror anything. This is why we make art. This is why anyone does anything. I mean, it's crazy to always kind of think that whatever you possibly could put out there might be received by somebody in a way that you could never even imagine. I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's obviously like a reason to make a movie like Sleepers if you are Barry Levinson and the producers and all this and that. But I don't think any of them could ever imagine that somewhere in a small Virginian town, there is young boys that are watching this movie where, because one of the more like compelling things about, you know, this story with your brother is, yes, would it helped you, but that apology that he gave you after seeing this, because that means that in his, like, he was able to receive that movie and understand something about himself, and I'm sure at great pain and great conflict, to then apologize. That means that this movie touches on something very human and very real, and if it can connect with people on this way, then this is the point of why anyone makes anything, whether it's music, any kind of art form. This is why we need it. This is why it's always like that Dead Poets Society. Ridiculous. I always say it's ridiculous because it's not, though.
Yeah, but it's
why we need things when we need them. And then when we receive them, whether we're ready for them or not, it stops us in our tracks, and we need to pay attention because it's healthy. It's a complete tribute to yourself and to the makers of this movie for being able to create something that means something so much. And that's the point of what we're doing, is sharing why it means that. So that's why it's not a diary entry. That's why it's not this or that. It's for this reason. And that's amazing. And again, I think this is really also a credit to how awesome you are as a person
Thanks.
It's true.
Well, I talk with my dad about stuff, and it's like, you know, we're here. Like, we're safe. Everything's good. This is resolved trauma. Oh, I mean, it's there. Believe me, it's there.
It doesn't go away.
Right. And I have depression in part because of this, and maybe, who knows, chemical imbalance, all the stuff I just talked about. Yeah. Like, who knows? But it's, you know, everything's good. Like, we're here. Yes.
Yeah.
Whoever needs to be medicated is properly medicated. It's no. So I do. Yeah. Thank you again for saying that. And yeah, this just isn't a movie that a lot of people talk about. And some people are like, oh yeah, that I saw that once. I saw that. And I kind of like to pull these little movies out of kind of from semi obscurity. Like, this movie's never streaming everywhere ever.
No, never. No.
I don't know what the hell happened to the rights, but it's never anywhere. So that's one reason why I think it goes underseen a lot. And I'm just trying to pull them out and go, you know, this meant something to me, and it always has. And this is a movie I get excited to put on. Like, when we locked into this, I was like, yes, Sleepers. Like, I love this movie, and I'm so excited to like do it. But we're going to talk about Barry Levinson next. Even among him and like his body of work, he doesn't talk about the movie a lot. The DVD has never had any special features. The DVD doesn't,
none.
The Blu-ray doesn't. There's nothing on it. Barry Levinson is no stranger to doing commentaries. I love his voice. He was born and raised in Baltimore, which is, you know, close-ish to where I grew up, and I just love that accent. So he's a lot of fun to listen to. It's basically, you know, Kevin Bacon's accent in the movie is like a pretty, even though they're in, I guess they're supposed to be in upstate New York, but it's a pretty thick Baltimore accent. What's your relationship with Barry Levinson? You watch any of his, are you a fan of his movies? I know we've talked about Diner on the pod.
That's our 1982.
Yeah, 1982, exactly. He's one of those journeyman directors, basically a Hollywood studio director who like started in 70s and 80s and just, he's still around. He's still making movies, and it just always kind of chips away. Sometimes his movies get nominated for Oscars. Sometimes they bomb, but then the next year he's just going to make another movie. You know, Rob Reiner, Mike Nichols was like this.
Yeah.
Barry Levinson. They're these guys who are just good at it.
Just like a solid like director that can kind of take almost any kind of material. No, I'm a fan. Like, I made a top five list of movies of his.
I want to hear. Do it.
Yeah.
Okay, good. What's your number five?
So number five is probably one that a lot of people really like, Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. Okay, I'm so glad you're mentioning, because he's made some huge movies that, of course, didn't make my top five because that's just how I am. And I do want to say that in 2014, holy shit, it was 10 years ago when I opened my blog. I was like, oh my God, this was 10 years ago. I covered him on my blog. So I've seen all of his movies, which is just, you know, a thing. But all right, Good Morning Vietnam. That's great.
It's good. And it's Robin Williams, I think, in some ways, like his... it's that peak Robin Williams of where he was at in his stand-up comedy and then transitioning into film. And I think it's also like that big introduction to that heartfelt. I think that's like one of the movies where we really get to start to understand that, oh, this guy's more than just a funny, funny person. He is he's got a lot in that well.
True. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. My number five is a very little seen Barry Levinson movie. It's very autobiographical. It's called Avalon. He released it in 1990. This is a coming of age film based heavily on his own story growing up. But what's cool about it is that it perfectly captures the invention of television coming into the homes in America. So you get life before television when it was the radio, and as it shows in this movie, like people, you know, talked. And then overnight, everyone was around a box in the living room and no one was talking and everyone was just watching a box. So it kind of, it traces that. Again, not very well seen, but I've always loved Avalon, number five.
Do you think, this is a crazy question really quick, just made me think of it. Do you think social media is like the new like television in that way?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah. Where, dude. yes. And it's so funny you bring this up. I just listened to his commentary. He does a commentary for Wag the Dog, a movie I love and a movie that is on my top five Barry Levinson films. And it was recorded separately. Dustin Hoffman's also in the commentary, but in it, so separately, they are both lamenting about how just terrible commercials are for society. Uh-huh. And I'm listening to this and I'm like, when did they record this commentary? Because they're talking about how commercials are going to kill us all. And the commentary was recorded in 1998. And I'm like, man, you think commercials are the worst thing for children and all this? Wait, just wait a few years till social media comes along. So yes, I do. I think social media became the new, whatever's melting the brains of the youth.
Yeah. And like taking away from like communication or, because like before, the thing about the TV comes out, what you just said, like everyone sits around, stops talking, looks at a box.
Yep.
Now we're just doing that on our phones. It's crazy.
Yeah. We all talk to it. We all communicate less. Number four from you.
The Natural.
Okay. Awesome. Great. I'm glad you mentioned that one too. Robert Redford. Great film. Yeah. Barry Levinson film.
Yep.
Good. It's not on my list, but good.
It's one of those romantic, baseball is the most romantic sport for film. It just, they're able to do that shit with it.
Yeah. Perfect ending, like genuinely iconic ending. My number four is Bugsy, starring Warren Beatty and Annette Bening. Love that movie.
I've never seen this. You've talked about this actually a couple times.
Yeah, written by James Toback, who's an interesting voice in cinema. He's not. Maybe I'll just cut that out. Never mind. Yes, it's a good movie. It's a good movie. He got it. He's been a bad man, but he did write some good screenplays back in the day. All right, what about your number three?
Number three is, I gotta put it, I really enjoy this movie, Rain Man.
Oh, nice.
It's one of my favorite Tom Cruise movies.
That's probably the biggest Barry Levinson film, one best picture, one best director, one best actor. There are so many great stories behind it that Dustin Hoffman really fought him hard to try to get kicked off the movie. He wanted to get fired. Like they were filming for a week and Hoffman's like, I don't have it. I don't have the character. I don't know what I'm doing. You need to go hire Richard Dreyfuss. Like I've talked to him. He'll come in and take my place. And and he's like, no, we're here. Like, stick with it. You got to do it. And I think that's where came from, the dependence on yeah. Like every time you don't think you're in it, stay. And that's how they kind of found it. So just great stories. The unsung hero of that movie actually is Tom Cruise. And some people have wondered if he gives a better performance than Dustin Hoffman. Because he changes. Tom Cruise changes in the movie. Dustin Hoffman doesn't change. Yeah. He stays. But yeah, it's next time you watch that movie, you as in like everyone, just kind of look at it with that lens.
That's cool.
At like what Tom Cruise is actually doing. I think he's doing more than people remember. That's all.
It's always kind of fascinating to me just being on an acting point of it where you realize that someone had a really hard time with this.
Yeah.
And yet because when it's finally there, no one would think in a million years that Dustin Hoffman struggled with this because he delivers a very, very, very good performance. But to know that behind the scenes that this was not easy for him and that he was to the point of like wanting to leave, that almost makes it even better in some ways that he was able to find it. And then the collaboration too.
Yep, exactly. My number three, already mentioned it, Wag the Dog, written by none other than David Mamet.
Yep.
It is a absolutely biting satire. I love it. There are two really good satires, at least two, that Barry Levinson has made, and Wag the Dog is just, it's tops. Great film.
Tops.
Tops.
Aces.
Aces, baby. What's your number two?
Number two is, I love this movie. What Just Happened?
That is his other satire. I absolutely love that movie. I was trying to think of a movie. Like, I'm watching all sorts of different shit right now for a director coming up, and that's really heavy. Last night I was like, you know, I should stick with Levinson. We're doing Levinson tomorrow. What Just Happened? Right there on Hulu. I put it on. I hadn't seen it in a while. This movie's fucking hilarious.
Like, it's hilarious.
So funny. And you're like, is this satire, or did they just let him put cameras here? Like, this is very thin satire about one of the most absurd industries in America, which is the movie industry. Love it.
Yep. It's so fun.
Oh, yes. That was your number two. My number two, his first film, some may call it his best, Diner. Made in 1982. Heavily improvised. Love it. Just absolutely love this movie. My dad turned me on to this movie so young, and I've always loved it.
I actually was like really like wondering how am I not putting this in there, especially because we talk so fondly about it on our 1982 podcast. It didn't make it, but I like this movie so much.
Yeah, that's okay. Number one.
I mean, it's the movie we're here to talk about, baby.
Goddamn right. I didn't know. I thought, I was like, he hasn't talked about Diner. He hasn't talked about what's happening. Envy? What about Envy? Envy's so bad.
Envy's got some funny moments.
It does. But I mean, I wanted to spend a little more time on him because we're probably never going to do like a Barry Levinson episode. But yes, I'm so glad you got to mention The Natural and Good Morning Vietnam. Other ones we missed, like, He's actually written a lot of his own movies. Some of them are his most personal ones. He wrote Diner. He wrote the screenplay for Tin Men. He wrote Avalon. Other Barry Levinson directed films, Toys with Robin Williams. Not a very well-remembered movie. Jimmy Hollywood with Joe Pesci. Not a very fondly remembered movie. He also wrote Liberty Heights, Man of the Year with Robin Williams, and Sleepers. I think Sleepers is his best screenplay. But yeah, he's got some interesting movies in there. Sphere. Remember Sphere?
Oh, my God.
Sphere. Bandits with Bruce Willis.
Billy Bob.
The Bay, which was like, Billy Bob. Yeah. The Bay, which was like a found footage horror movie. Not too bad. The Survivor, which no one talked about. It was Ben Foster played like a Holocaust survivor who had to.
Yeah.
A boxer. It wasn't that good, but that's okay. You know, we're here.
I just like Ben Foster.
I do too. He was good. He put like a lot into it. All right. You know, sometimes we start with the plot because this cast in Sleepers is so big. We're going to go through all these people first and we're going to call out any scenes we want from Sleepers along the way. But after the cast, whatever we missed, we'll go through the movie kind of in order, but it's going to be fun. Well, first of all, Sleepers, the title is a slang term for juvenile delinquents who serve sentences longer than 9 months. And that is the fate of our four boys shortly after the movie begins. I'm going to start with who plays them as adults. We have Jason Patrick as Lorenzo, better known as Shakes, throughout the movie. Joe Perino played young Shakes. He was one I haven't seen much from him.
Yeah.
You know, post-Sleepers. But Patrick was in The Lost Boys, After Dark, My Sweet, Rush, which is a nuts movie, Geronimo. Jason Patrick, what can I say about him? He is an actor I have always... What?
You're missing the biggest one. Speed 2 Cruise Control. Come on.
I'm doing everything pre-Sleepers. Speed 2 was what he took his Sleepers clout and went to. He probably could have done like any movie. He's the star and narrator of a Barry Levinson movie. And he's like, what am I going to use this clout for? Speed 2 Cruise Control. Baby. You're goddamn right I am. I'm not talking about any of their post-careers because it's kind of interesting where everyone was at the time. But
gotcha.
I've always loved Jason Patrick. He did not have a good time making this movie. It doesn't sound like he's ever had a good time making any movie. He's been notoriously difficult to work with, but wow, I love his performance as Shakes, and I love his voiceover in the movie. I've always been really, really drawn to it.
I love his voiceover. The voiceover, I think, is perfect. It is a very, very good voiceover movie because not a lot of these voiceover movies because there's a lot of explanation and exposition and stuff throughout this, but I think it really serves the piece, and I think his voice is the type of voice that really helps. It's a very there's a lot of gravity, there's a lot of weight, there's it's an easy voice to listen to. Actually, the very first time I saw this movie, I had a big issue with the separation between the kids and the adults.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have that much this time around.
A young up-and-comer named Brad Pitt played one of the sleepers, one of the adult sleepers. He's playing Michael Sullivan. Brad Renfro played young Michael Sullivan. He was the kid in The Client. So he was the biggest, kid actor in the movie. And he went on to have, Brad Renfro went on to have a good career and then passed away too soon, unfortunately. But we all know who Brad Pitt is now. Before Sleepers, we had Thelma and Louise, River Runs Through It, California, True Romance. I mean, the dude is a white hot. Interview with the Vampire, Legends of the Fall, 7-12 Monkeys, which he gets nominated for an Oscar for. Right after the Oscar nomination, he's in Sleepers. Brad Pitt did not like this performance of his at all, which is sad.
Oh, really?
But I just felt like mentioning that. Yeah, he said he was a little too green. I like the accent work, it kind of dips in. But I never said this was a perfect movie. I don't know if anyone's ever said Sleepers is a perfect movie, but it's damn sure perfect to me. But if someone's going to be like, yeah, I kind of have a problem with this performance of this, I'm like, yeah, I get it. I get it. It's fine.
And that's all that it is. This is not like none of this takes away from the movie. I think that's actually a testament to the movie. I think it's also probably, I'll kind of open this up a little bit. You spend so much time with this movie as a certain movie with these kids, you're kind of like really engrossed in, you've made these relationships with these kids, and because you know what they've gone through, there is like an element of like you're feeling a certain way, and then there is a very, very strong cutoff to now, oh, we're adults now. That's the way the story goes. But there is like an adjustment period where you're trying to separate the two. And I think almost I can say this across the board, and this is, again, not a knock on the movie at all. I like all the kids' performances better than I like the adult performances.
Oh, what a cool take. I love this. I love it.
I really do. And I did feel like that, too. The second time I saw it, I go, I really like these kids. And I feel like the adults might not exactly match up. Maybe it's the look. Maybe it's just the attitudes. I think that was my Jason Patrick one, was like, he does not remind me. So it's weird because I don't think Jason Patrick does a bad job at all, but he doesn't remind me of young Shakes. I don't see the similarities. I do see the similarities in the two other ones that we're going to get to.
John and
I
Tom.
Actually, I especially John.
John, yeah, I'll do him next. Yeah.
Yeah, like he, like that is the correlation. I'm like, that's totally that kid right now. And that's not, it is hard to say because, like, did these actors get to see the kids' performances? Who shot first? Was there?
It was the grown-ups were cast first, and then they cast the kids to try to like match them.
Oh, so the kids were trying to match the adults.
Yeah, I don't know if they were like watching their takes or anything. I don't think it was anything like that, but I think it was, all the adults had some work. Well, not Billy Crudup, who played Tommy. I know I said I was going to do John, but he plays the adult Tommy, and that's his first major movie role, which is crazy. And then, of course, young Jonathan Tucker plays young Tommy, and Jonathan Tucker went on to, he's still in movies. We love Jonathan Tucker.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
And then, Ron Eldard plays the adult John Riley, and it's Jeffrey Wigdor, who I've never seen again as young John. And that boy is great. Like, you believe everything. Like, all of his, like, he's the little one in the group, so he has the most fire to him. Like, I get that. But then he's also the first to get picked on. Ron Elder was Mickey in Drop Dead Fred, personal favorite of mine. He's the cop who pulls. Oh, I love Drop Dead Fred. I love it. I saw it in, they played it in Alamo like a couple months ago. Who even knows at this point? It was a blast. Watch that movie every Christmas Eve with my brother. Just a tradition. Weird tradition. Aww. That's a good memory.
That's nice.
He also played the cop who pulls Pacino over in Scent of a Woman. And just like, what a shit cop. Like, he can't even tell the driver. He just pulled over is blind. An idiot. He goes blind himself in Deep Impact. Good actor. I love him in this movie, too. And
oh, yeah. He is my favorite of the boys grown up.
Oh, if he's your favorite, then let me get your ear on this one. Let me bend your ear on this one. There was someone already cast in this role, but he had to drop out because he got really, really busy. And that person was the Mighty Duck himself, Emilio Estevez.
No,
what
really?
Do you think of that? That could have been interesting. I think he could have, because this is Mission Impossible. So same year as Mission Impossible 1, where he's like, you know, kind of scraggly and he's... You know, spike him out in the elevator, but it could have been interesting. I like that they went with a more unknown actor, but I'm going to go through a few of these sliding doors, these casting sliding doors.
Yes.
But that's interesting. That's an interesting one. I like it because Ron Elder, like, he has that huge scene in the restaurant. He's got to like look at himself in the mirror. He has to change in that mirror. He has to be like, I can't wait to talk about that scene. So those were our sleepers. Now we'll go to the neighborhood. We have Minnie Driver as the grown Carol. She's a friend to all the boys. She was in Circle of Friends, Goldeneye. Can't forget her cameo in Goldeneye. Take a hike. Sandra Bullock was originally cast as Carol. But she was already involved in A Time to Kill, another movie about perhaps the justified killing of pieces of shit. But that's another sliding doors thing there. We have a little actor named Robert De Niro coming in as Father Bobby Carrillo. This is his first collaboration with Barry Levinson. They went on to do Wag the Dog, What Just Happened, The Wizard of Lies, which I had never seen and just watched for the first time, the Bernie Madoff movie on HBO. Vittorio Grossman plays King Benny. This dude has 135 credits on IMDb. Sleepers was one of his last movies. He died 4 years later. Have not seen a lot of his Italian movies, no. But God, do I love him as King Benny. Just perfect casting. Perfect casting.
The whole entire neighborhood is
so well cast. Everyone.
So well cast.
Including Bruno Kirby as Shakes' father, who doesn't have a lot to do, but he's so brutal early on. Just the way, first of all, it's the beatings that are like taking, kind of place off camera. Then the way he puts his arm around young Shakes when they see that dude just like fucking hanging from the streetlight, and the frequency of the beatings and how, I mean, it's crazy how when Shakes gets in trouble, he's just flipping out at the situation. You think he'd be taking it out on Shakes, but he's like, I've done enough time for everybody. It's oddly endearing to watch him be flipping out on behalf of Shakes as opposed to flipping out on Shakes. I don't know.
Yeah.
Really good performance. It's a good performance. Frank Medrano, sorry about the last name, as Fat Man. I love this guy. A lot of people know him as Fat Ass in Shawshank Redemption. He's poor guy who didn't survive his first night. He also has one of my favorite lines in Sleepers. It is something I repeat often, much of the chagrin to whomever I say it to. I give a fuck about most people. Oh, God, I love that line. Dustin Hoffman, Academy Award winner Dustin Hoffman showing up as what, like the ninth lead as Danny Snyder. In addition to alcohol, I have a slight, nothing major,
slight,
drug issue.
Slight God, drug I issue.
It's so good.
This is one of my favorite, because he comes in like so late in the movie.
So late and just bumbling and
just like what a character to introduce. Like a guy is like, I'm an alcoholic. I can't do this. On top of this, I got this and that. It's a great character introduction. I am a huge fan of Dustin Hoffman in this movie.
And then George Adias. I've never seen him before, but he plays the hot dog vendor, and I wanted to give him a little shout out because that scene when they show him like walking into the courthouse and they give him, his justice with that narration. Like, we never saw him as a man. We just saw him as a free lunch, and we didn't know about the family back home. I really, really love that. I love this is a movie about the sleepers, but it is painting a perfect portrait of this whole neighborhood. Get it so well. We understand, may have never been to Hell's Kitchen, New York, but we understand how important these square blocks are to this group.
And And he does so much with no dialogue.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
In that scene where he's, when the kids are looking at him and he's looking at them, there's like, to me, I kind of took that as like, okay, you might have just destroyed my livelihood in a way, like mm-hmm. destroyed my cart, but none of this was worth what we're both here for today. Like me chasing after you. Yeah, this
didn't need
you.
To happen.
Yeah, like mm-hmm. this didn't need to happen. But then there's also like, there doesn't seem to be any anger. Like there's anger
right,
when he's
right.
when he's chasing him, but not right now. And that's such a nice choice because like that's like it'd be so easy for him to see the kids and just be like, "You motherfuckers! Like this is all your fault and everything."
Yeah, and to give him the scene of him on the stand, my livelihood is ruined and all that stuff, which I'm not, you know, he would have been entitled to, but that, we've seen that so many times.
Yeah,
just giving us that look and some really empathic narration from Shakes, you're like, "Shit, yeah." He is a human being. These people out here serving us food, they are human beings. Yep. They have families. Yeah. Yeah.
And conversely, in the chase, when they're looking at each other from across the street, and he's got that, and there's the voiceover, Shakes has got that, like, you'd probably know it better, but he's like, he looks like he could go, like, 10 more blocks.
Yeah, just on hate alone.
Just on hate alone. That was it.
Yep.
And,
yep.
And you, I didn't see necessarily hate in the eyes, but I saw conviction. Like, yeah. What are you doing? Because I'm going to be going too. And like, what a great line to just mirror that on. Oh, it's so good.
A lot of those best lines are plucked like straight out of the book. And it's just, that's why I recommend, you know, it's not a book that's like in a rotation a lot. You know, you won't be able to do the coveted, I shouldn't say coveted. You won't be able to do the audiobook format. Coveted, the hotly desired Sleepers audiobook is not out there. Tell you what's not desired. These fucking guards. First off, I'm gonna do Lenny Lofton as Styler, actor I don't know much about. Then we have Jeffrey Donovan as Henry Addison, who was not well known when this movie was made, but he went on to star in Burn Notice. He was in Changeling.
Oh,
he
wears
the thick glasses in Sicario. You know, he's kind of a badass. Terry Kinney shows up as Ralph Ferguson. He's what a great character actor. I think his best role and probably his most famous one was in Oz, the HBO show, right after this, where he's actually playing like a counselor to the prisoners and he's trying to help them, which is not his role in Sleepers.
No.
And the head of the guards is Kevin Bacon, playing one Sean Noakes. Kevin Bacon, he was in, of course, Friday the 13th, but his first breakout, his major breakout role was in Barry Levinson's Diner. Goes on to be in Footloose, Quicksilver, Tremors, Flatliners, JFK, A Few Good Men, The Air Up There, The River Wild, Murder in the First, Apollo 13. When I saw Sleepers, I was pretty much meeting the guy from Footloose, Tremors, and The Air Up There. And he is really nice guys in all of those movies. And I was like, what, I probably had seen Apollo 13. It's a small part. We're going to talk a lot about Noakes as we go. I just don't know where this character came from. I haven't seen him do anything like this before or since. There were some really heavy hitters considered for this role. We have Willem Dafoe, Gary Sinise, J.T. Walsh, John Travolta, and here he is, Ray Liotta.
Wow.
I like all of those actors. Kevin Bacon is the least likely choice among them and therefore seizes it the best and does a complete, what do you call it? It's not stunt casting, but like a role reversal for what we're used to him as. And he's gone on to play like villains and stuff. He's on a show, City on the Hill. I watched the first season. I fell off it. He's a crooked cop in that. He was in that movie Cop Car. Like, but those villains are, these are big. These are big villains. Noakes is not a big villain. He's so menacing and terrifying, and everything he does is in the shadows. It's hushed when a priest is coming to say hi. Yeah, make sure we don't talk about this. You know, everything's, it's not a loud performance at all. That's what makes it so terrifying.
I like the way you just said that about the loudness, because the note that I had, like, that there's just so many, but the one is, what is it about his voice in this movie that it's something that, like, you just hear it. And it sounds pure evil, because he's not putting on some type of like idea of a performance of like, like, I don't know, like this idea of like a menacing type of like heavy, thick, deep voice, like the devil or something like that. It's
yeah,
this very, oh, not high pitched, but it's it doesn't even sound like it, there's no there's almost, oh, this is a weird thing. There's no masculinity behind it in a way.
Yeah, it's fair, you know, your time here hadn't taught you shit. It's almost like, it's a weasel. Come on, guys, stop. Yeah, stop fucking around here. Like, stop doing it. He's not like yelling. There's no baritone.
No,
that's what makes him so scary. Is that even the first time you see him? Like, he's got the cigarette. He's always spinning the baton. But he's just standing in front of the door, and you're like, oh, come on, Kevin Bacon. Like, how bad could this be? Like the guy who starts the cafeteria food fight, Dash Mihawk.
Mihawk, yes.
Last name. Who's been in a ton of stuff. Like, he's a great character actor. He's in, I've always loved him. He starts the fight. That dude, I mean, maybe if all four guards get on that guy at once, it's a different story. But that guy against Sean Noakes is not, that's why he's like, all right, go back to your room. You're done with lunch. That's how Noakes talks to him. You know, he's not trying to bully him because he can't. He can't. Noakes very, very deliberately picks the smallest person, who's John, in the whole fucking, in Wilkinson. Like, he picks the smallest one on purpose. This is what these predators do. This is how they do it. They, you know, pluck him out. And yeah, there's, it's just not a masculine macho performance. It's not like a sweaty drunk, I'm hulked out working out. It's the reason why the menace is there is because this could just be fucking anybody. Like, it could be anybody. Yeah. You don't know. This dude does not look crazy if you look at him. He doesn't.
No. I remember even one point I just closed my eyes during like a part of his speech. I couldn't shake it. I was like, even though I've seen the movie and I know like the atrocities that his character is about to do, but it's like, but why is this voice just like gnawing at me? So I closed my eyes and to take it in, and I was like, oh, this is so uncomfortable and like so disturbing, but in the most compelling of ways, which is why like this character is so, I almost don't know how you do this.
Yeah.
Because it's so disturbing, yet you can't not look at him. Mm-hmm. You actually can't take your eyes off of him.
That's what's so disturbing about it. Yeah. As soon as he just walks into a room, you're like, oh God, here he comes. Like, oh
yeah.
No. But then you're so compelled to look at him. Like, what is this guy gonna do? Like, what's he gonna do?
And I think it's very easy to kind of play a character like this in a way that's almost so disturbing that you're looking away as opposed to being drawn in, which is crazy because you're drawn into like, what is he going to do? What is he going to say? That's really a testament to how Kevin Bacon pulled this off so well. And because we wouldn't be talking about a character like this with such almost like praise in a way because of how disturbing he made it, but so compelling to watch. Like, it's crazy. He's excellent. He's fucking excellent.
He really is. Of just a few others from the cast, James Pickens Jr. plays the nice blackguard who comes and saves the day.
Love that scene.
A little bit.
Love that.
Yeah, it's a great scene. John Slattery shows up as a teacher.
Yup. These are characters like that, like, I just want to say about them, like, they're giving us the reprieve. They're giving these boys a breath of fresh air while they're just being suffocated by these oppressors and these physical assailants. So they are met with some decency in this place with these two characters right here.
And those are really jarring too. Not everyone in Wilkinson is a monster. Like, the teacher gives him, you know, the copy of the Count of Monte Cristo, which he still has all those years later. Like, it means something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Huge cast of characters. And again, this is what the movie was sold on. But now that we've introduced everyone, let's start to dig into the movie itself, because we open in Hell's Kitchen, summer 1966. We already mentioned, I made a note that I love the timbre of Jason Patrick's voiceover, because it's just so, he's got like a subtle New York accent that just barely pokes through, but then it can be very matter of fact. It's like, even when he's talking about the abuse, there's no, he's not going up and down like an emotional register. And I appreciate that. It's like, it's obviously Shakes' story, but he's presenting it kind of like a journalist would, which, you know, I know he's what his character's trying to aspire to. So an all-timer voiceover to me, for sure.
I like that you used that word again that I was looking for earlier, timber. That's what it
oh,
is.
Oh, were you? Okay.
Yeah, I used the
Thank
word
you.
Ease.
With an
but
R-E.
I think it's, yeah, the R-E.
We get introduced to the core group of friends. We got Shakes, Michael, Tom, Little John. We meet the young hip priest played by Robert De Niro. I love the bit with the nuns clacker.
Oh,
the father
yeah.
does it. Nuns are such easy targets. This is such a genuinely earnest character. This is just a Robert De Niro good guy.
Yep.
There's nothing shitty about this guy. I love him. Again, I think it's crazy. This was his first collaboration with Barry Levinson, but this is a priest who smokes cigarettes, who plays basketball, who, you know, is understands the danger that goes on in his neighborhood, but is also just trying to lend a helping hand when he can. Even when he finds out, like, that Shakes and John were listening to the women's confession, just, like, hysterical. He just makes them do work. He's not punishing
yeah.
them with, like, terrible stuff. He knows that the street could eat them alive, and he's trying to save them from that.
Father Robert Carrillo was a longshoreman's son who was as comfortable sitting on a bar stool in a back alley saloon as he was standing at the altar during high mass. He had toyed with the life of petty crime before finding his calling. He was a friend. A friend who just happened to be a priest.
You want crap like that does to your body?
Come on, Father. Be smoking.
And it's just such a good, good man. Like, it's really wonderful to watch De Niro do this. I loved him in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. De Niro, as Father Bobby, steps in to be a sort of surrogate father in some ways for Shakes, because
yeah,
Bruno Kirby's just, you know, all sorts of bad. And then the other surrogate father is King Benny. King Benny is an ex-hitman for Lucky Luciano. That's a tough job. And so we're getting to know him. We're getting to see the boys come to work for King Benny. The beginning of this movie very much is cut and assembled and moves like, say, Goodfellas. And I get it.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, I'm okay with it. We, you know, on this podcast, I think we've talked so much about all of the Pulp Fiction imitators that came out in the wake of that film. Goodfellas was first. Like, after Goodfellas, I mean, the wave of shitty crime movies inspired by Goodfellas in the 90s. That was a real thing. And if you want to, if some people were to write sleepers off as that, I hear you. I think this is the best version of a Goodfellas imitation.
To me, it's The Community.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the, you're, what you're doing this whole entire time is you're getting to one, and the voiceover really helps. You're getting to know the way of life in Hell's Kitchen. This is at the time, this is what people were like, this is how things were. I actually really appreciate how they talked about the domestic abuse in all the families.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were saying, your point about Bruno Kirby, you know, but the way that everyone, this is how it was, you know, it
no
wasn't just Bruno
it.
Kirby. Yeah. No one's
oh, yeah.
Bruno Kirby doing this. This is all these families. This is how they are. And it's always kind of amazing to me in a movie, in any movie where, you know, you only have a chunk of time to showcase the world, and how well can you actually articulate and present this world to where the audience receives it and feels like they know it, like they get it. And this movie does that. Like, I mm-hmm. really felt like, I think this movie just absolutely cooks. Like, it just
oh, yeah.
flies. It does yep. not, I never once noticed time at all. It just, it's like this flying machine just goes. So all that is to also say that within a certain amount of time, I feel like I know what this environment is, what this world is like, and I'm in it. And I don't know how you do that. Like, think about it. Like, you have, like, establishing shots, very quick scenes with these characters, in, out, in, out, in, out, and then you got a voiceover on a script. Those are just the actions and the words. How
yeah.
do you actually communicate that? And it works. Like, I don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah, this was assembled by Stu Linder, and we're going to get to some more of his credits. But it does. It absolutely moves. You're cooking along, especially in these early scenes. The music's blaring. We get the pop music,
yep.
you know, Walk Like a Man, which is going to come back around. I love at the end of this first little block of time is when they're all playing basketball, and De Niro explains the Sistine Chapel and how long it took Michelangelo
yeah.
to paint it. And John goes,
hey, Father, how long did it take him, you know, painting the ceiling and all?
Took him about 9 years.
9 years.
That's right.
I had a Puerto Rican guy do my whole apartment in 2 days, and he had a bum leg.
And I don't know what I'm going to do with you guys.
And he had a bum leg. I love that so much. But yeah, and then, oh man, talking about, you know, the influence, like the danger of Hell's Kitchen, but how also everyone looks out for each other. Winter 1967, the first scene we get is Robert De Niro threatening this massive guy who just beat the shit out of Little John. And this is just an all-timer scene for me. I mean, the way De Niro carries himself with so much confidence, and you kind of see that flash of like Jake LaMotta come back. You know, he's like, you won't need a doctor. You'll need a priest to pray over your body. I love that scene. Ugh.
It's really, really good. And it's, yeah, because the guy is so big. And it's also, you know, kind of like for that other actor, too. Like, he, you know, he's probably not used to being called out on this, because he does not get defensive. He does not, like, you know, like, stand up to De Niro.
Mm-mm.
He just kind of, like, almost, like, shrinks in a way. Because De Niro's just sort of like, how much you figure he weighs? You know, 80 pounds? You're a big guy. The guy doesn't look like he's stupid. He doesn't realize what he's getting at, but he's just sort of like, yeah, you know. Like, he's backing away, cowering almost, to De Niro, who, as he said, like, I'm not as big as you, but I'm also not 85 pounds, and you're going to have a real problem if this happens again. Like, it's just so good.
What are you, about 220, 230?
Yeah.
You're a big guy. How much do you think John Riley weighs? 80, 85? That's not even a featherweight. If this were a fight, you'd be way out of your division.
Look, it was a slap. It was nothing.
Well, next time you'll be meeting me, and I may not be in your division, but I do weigh more than 85 pounds. And you won't need a doctor when I'm done. You'll need a priest to pray over your body.
I love it. And just that smile he has on his face. It's like, yeah, he intimidates the big guy. He intimidates the bully. Yep. He stands up to him like, all right, yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm not in your division, but I do weigh more than 80 pounds.
That's what it was.
So
yes.
Good. Yeah. And then we jump again to the summer of 1967. The temperature topped out at 98 degrees on the day our lives were forever altered. We have this great, tragic 5-minute set piece of the hot dog vendor sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And for a group of city kids, it's a pretty solid scam. It just sucks they have apparently been doing it to this one guy, like, over and over. But the scam is simple. Shakes or whomever, but today it's going to be Shakes, goes to a hot dog vendor, orders one hot dog, and runs off without paying. The vendor then has two options. They can accept the loss of the hot dog, or he can chase after Shakes, abandoning his cart, leaving the other three boys to feast in his absence. It's a fun scam. It gets underway. A chase begins. But Michael thinks it's a good idea to move the cart so that when the vendor comes back, the cart's in a different place. Things get way out of control. The cart is held over a subway staircase. Cart slips, thunders down the stairs. That is a great scene when they're just cutting back and forth between the slow motion. Then you get boom, and how loud that cart is going down.
The
it would be so loud, and the echo would just go and go. And you're like, oh my God. And then, yeah, you see it smash an innocent businessman at the end of the kind of train platform at the bottom of the stairs, and that great matter-of-fact delivery from Jason Patrick via voiceover. To this day, I don't know why we did it. And you can just hear, like, I did dumb shit when I was a kid. I didn't do anything like this, but I did dumb shit. Like, I looked back even the next day, let alone decades later, and I'm like, the hell were you thinking, man? What was that? I mean, that's what time gives us, but
like they say, like it's like one of the hottest days of the year. You can actually feel like the heat and the look of this whole entire. It does. Even just like the lived in reality of them, like on the roof, you know, in that one scene as they're talking about, they're on something.
They're on the roof right when it begins.
Yeah, they're on the roof. And it just makes you think like that's just what kids did. Like, there's nowhere to go. We're just playing on the roof. I loved also like it's kind of stereotypical, but it's like the broken fire hydrant. And in the streets.
Yeah, playing, cooling themselves down. Yeah, playing stickball. Yeah.
But that's what, and all the adults are like, no, the kids are fine. They're just playing. This is what they do.
Yeah.
Like, there's this very, like, that community again, but you're getting all that in this scene. And Yeah, and then for the chase to actually start, like, what is that really cool, like, that slow motion? The movie never looks like this again. I don't even know what kind of, it's like a filter almost that they put on the guy, the hot dog vendor chasing Shakes.
It's got, I know, I mean, it's definitely like an in-camera trick. It's like they jacked up the shutter speed, but then ran it in slow motion or something. I don't know, but yeah, really cool, like, in-camera tricks. It's just like in the cinematographer, Michael Ballhouse, that's just like in his bag. This guy shot Color of Money.
Yeah.
Goodfellas. Like, this dude, like, knows how to do cool stuff, but not, it's not an effect we're seeing over and over throughout Sleepers. Just using it right now. Even slow motion is not done a lot, only in very, very key sequences. And I love that. But yeah, it's a really cool effect to, like, oh, cool, now we got this, like, chase sequence in the middle of this kind of movie, and there's fun music playing, and it's cool. This is fun. Until it's not, but...
Until it's not, and that's exactly my next point, is, like, the tone change going from, like, it's very beat by beat, like, it's fun. And then as soon as Michael gets the idea to move the cart, like, we all as the audience are like,
no,
do we really need to go here? Like, I mean,
it's one step too far. It's too far.
The gag is already happening. And they're like, all right, now they're doing it. And so now we're building that tension. And then now they're near the subway. And you're like, guys, you're in a really crowded area. Like, what are you doing? And then, like, what, like, did they think that they were, his voiceover, it's like, to this day, I don't know why we did it, because you're not thinking, like, why would you even try to do that?
I guess the idea is, if they hold it over the edge, instead of the guy coming and, like, the vendor coming and tackling them, or stay here till the cops get here, he's going to have no choice but to grab the cart. But I guess they think their eight young hands are as strong as two adult hands, and they're not. And it just slips out of their hands. Like, that's as Lil Jon says, these carts are heavier than shit. And when you try to hold it over a steep staircase, that's what happens. But man, I'll just never forget the first time seeing this and hearing the sound of that hot dog cart. And it also looks really scary, with everything.
Oh, it looks terrifying.
Flying out.
Everything's flying.
Yeah,
everywhere.
Everything's flying. But you don't even know if it's going to hit someone, but it's a terrifying image straight on. Oh. And just brilliant filmmaking. Just a nice little slice of, like, brilliant filmmaking right here in the middle of the movie.
The plan, as it turned out, was as simple and as dumb as anything we had ever done. We were to hold the cart on the top edge of the stairwell, leaning it downward, and wait for the vendor. We were to let it go the second he grabbed the handles, then we'd leave the scene as he struggled to ease the cart back onto the sidewalk. To this day, I don't know why we did it, but we would all pay a price. It only took a minute, but in that minute, everything changed.
I wonder how many takes, because there's so many cuts and so many different angles that they're capturing this hot dog vend, this hot dog stand falling down these stairs, where, like, you know, that just couldn't have been one take. So how many carts did they get? How much did they have to clean up, do this again, get it from this angle, get it from that? Like, that's a lot.
These are the stuff that, like, a commentary would be great for, just a lit, like, a making of on the Blu-ray, just something. I would think $44 million, 1996, you might be able to get two or three takes, because you need a different card every time.
Yeah.
Two or three times, but I bet they had a lot of cameras rolling, a lot of cameras.
You have to, so you can just catch it all, and and then just edit it. They probably had a lot of footage, like, this is all looks good, just put it all together.
Put it all together. But then this is the event that, unfortunately, well, directly after the event, we get Father Bobby consoling Shakes. And again, De Niro is just, the way he's so gentle with that actor. And he's like, you know, just smoking. And, every door I try to open, it's getting closed. I can't do anything.
There's scenes between De Niro and Joe Perino.
Yeah.
That are just, they have great chemistry, I think. I think there's just... There's a very honest vulnerability that both of them get to in their scenes. There's one coming up that we're about to get to in the prison that I love even more.
Yeah.
But, like, just when Perino says to him, he goes, I don't want to face it, Father. You know, like, like, that's just the truth, man. That's just like, I don't want to go and do this thing that I have to do. And De Niro's just like, you got to face it. Like, you have to, because if you keep running, you'll run the rest of your life.
You might think when you're 12 or 13, I can outrun this, but my guy, you've never been out of Hell's Kitchen. You're not running anywhere. The court case does not go their way. I like that they kind of breeze through it. We're going to get to a court case, so we breeze through this one. But they're off to the Wilkinson Home for Boys for 12 to 18 months. That is more than enough time to destroy a few lives. Soon as they are out of the neighborhood, the pop music stops. It's been kind of wall-to-wall pop music, which I've loved up until then. And now it stops. And now that even the temperature of the color has changed. It's not hot and sweaty in Hell's Kitchen. Nope. It's cold, ice cold. And
blues.
The blues, the very, very deep blues. We've already talked about Kevin Bacon as Noakes a bit, but in terms of that, the banality of evil, I see there's, I don't know what makes Noakes tick. I don't know where he's come from. It's, oh my God. Again, just the hair is parted in such a way. There's a coldness and a blankness to his eyes. It's so terrifying. Even the way that he smokes is terrifying. And I found some trivia. I just love this, that he's playing a very tense, scary person on screen, that as soon as they called cut, he would just be like throwing footballs with the boys and stuff and like playing around with them and just being really, really cool with him, not staying like method at all. And yeah. I love that.
I mean, if you just take that opening scene, the introduction of him through, like, that's the thing. You don't even see his body. You just see his face.
And again, you're like, how bad can this be? This is the guy from Footloose. And then, you know, take off your clothes and it's like, okay, well, this could be kind of normal. No, all of it. And you're like, why?
Huh? And
oh, man.
And there's a moment, and it's so gross. It's so fucking gross. But like, when he's naked and you can see his eyes dip down.
Oh yeah.
In that moment, there's like actual desire, like right then and there. And you know, you just kind of, I mean, but that's the fucking commitment of that character. Like that's his fucking truth, and it's fucking awful. But like, he was not afraid to go there
right away.
Yeah. And then you'd have to shake that off. Like, okay, well, fuck it. You know, let's go do something else right now.
Yeah, we're gonna, you know, as we get to the section, we're gonna start to talk about some not very pleasant things, but you see an acknowledgement in his eyes of here's my new toy for my friends and I. And yet I don't enjoy saying these words, but that's what's going on here. We don't necessarily know that yet, but we're like, all right, what is this? You know, and then we get the
you get it though. Like,
you get there's some very sinister thing going on here. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And something that's just not right. Like, this is not right. And like, what are you doing? Yeah.
Oof. And then they have the, you know, the food fight of sorts. Not really a food fight. It's just a fight in the cafeteria. They're told to eat off the floor and kind of like, man, this is gross. I really hope it doesn't get any worse than this. And then, they were just down here in this basement hallway. And this scene, I mean, keep in mind, I saw this movie. I was alone the first time I saw it. I was 11. I was very confused about some of the words that were being chosen. I didn't know what these things were. I was shocked. I was terrified. The way we hear that chain banging against the light bulb, and that's going to come back as a motif really for everyone involved, the perpetrators and the victims. It was all so disconcerting. Yeah, this is the first scene of abuse. And what I want to say is that it's terrible what is insinuated in this scene and even words that are said. But this is a movie that's going there, right? So if we're going there and this is what it's about, you showed us as much as I can tolerate, and I appreciate it for that. That's all I can say. That this could have gone so much worse. It could be so much worse in what they do, but there is, this is a weird word to say for sleepers, but there is a restraint to some of these scenes in terms of what they don't show us, that we get it. Everything that needs to be said has been said. We understand.
It strikes a really good balance between going there and then not, like, it's not playing it safe. It's very, very well handled for that material.
You've explained everything sufficiently. No one watching the movie has questions about what these boys have suffered, but we did not need to see it. We all understand what they suffered. We don't need to see it. And they're going to show us more flashes later when they're flashbacks, when they are adults that are, that's honestly like some of the most graphic stuff. Yeah,
that's actually worse in a lot of ways. Like, at least for me, my viewing experience, like, those got to me more. I was like,
Chronologically, this is when Father Bobby shows up. De Niro comes and visits. Shake and visits Shakes, and even like Bacon, like walking down the stairs going, you know, like, let's just keep everything quiet here. And you're like, yep. And he's like staring at him through the window. This is a very important scene. We already mentioned it, but it's very important for what's going to happen 15 years later, because Father Bobby admits, you know, that he and his friend were sent here. And it's a little bit of a question of the movie. I don't know if Father Bobby knows what's going on in terms of the abuse. He knows they're not having a good time, but does he know the extent of it? Does he know that guards are involved? So basically, does this impact his decision later to lie on the stand and to perjure himself?
There's a moment that I took from the scene where De Niro, like, he's asking him, like, is everything all right in here? Like, what's going on? And Shakes is particularly in that moment not answering. De Niro, like, looks up and, like, away, and, like, his eyes do that De Niro thing where he, like, squinches him up and is, like, thinking. In that moment, I was sort of like, is he thinking that the worst that possible thing could be happening right now?
Yeah. Yeah, and De Niro has that great line when he's talking about his friend, because he's going to visit his friend, you know, who's in actual prison for committing a triple murder. And he said, this place killed him. It made him not care anymore. And he is describing who young John and Tom will turn into, that they're going to become these killers who just don't care about anything anymore. And then, because of the personal story I told earlier, there are some scenes that really get me from this movie, and they can just be lines of voiceover. And when we see Ferguson walking out of young John's room, and you kind of understand that he's a lot of bad stuff has gone on. Jason Patrick says,
a number of the inmates, as tough as they acted during the day, would often cry themselves to sleep at night. There were other cries too. These differed from those filled with fear and loneliness. They were lower and muffled, the sounds of pained anguish. Those cries can change the course of a life. They are cries that once heard can never be erased from memory. On this one night, those cries belonged to my friend John, when Ralph Ferguson paid him a visit.
Those cries can change the course of a life. They are cries that once heard can never be erased from memory. Very, very good line. Very, very good line. Slattery, we just touched on Slattery, but I do like that he shows up, and you do need that. You need, like, this reprieve of, like, oh, there's actually a good adult in this hell. Like, it exists.
Yes.
It exists.
Yep.
And then we get to, oh my God, it's this touch football sequence, because even the first time I saw this, I didn't get satisfaction watching it, because I knew what the repercussions were going to be. I knew that even though all the sleepers in Wilkinson, they recruit this young star, Rizzo, played by Eugene Bird, who was Wink in 8 Mile. He was also the kid in Dead Man. He's a good actor, but he kind of, like, you know, run stuff a little bit. You know, the guards don't mess with him physically, but all the guards are racist. So the sleepers, our four sleepers, convince Rizzo to basically, like, we're playing touch football with these guards. Let's just beat the shit out of them and get a little for ourselves. And it's, I want to talk about the sequence, because first I want to talk about how you feel about, like, how it looks, because it's very, like, blue and overexposed and all that stuff.
It's almost like a music video of that time. Yeah. It reminds me of, like, it's very experimental. It's very, very choppy, very kind of, like, we just get these images and they're moving, but they're not moving at the normal rate of, like, how things are. It's almost like a flip book in a way. You understand that this was a very significant moment for everything. Like, it was a significant moment. It was a significant moment for the boys, as in the voiceover and all those flashing clips where they're like, we're taking this back for us. And you get that the guards, like, they're humiliated.
Yeah.
And just getting the shit kicked out of them. So it's a cool way to, as opposed to, let's just film this like touch football thing and actually show it this way. Like, let's just go a different direction. And because it's fast too. Like, what do we need to get? Yeah, and how do we just evoke emotion? I like that this movie kind of does that. That it's the only time the movie ever breaks away from its look that it's set up for itself.
Very true. And it the only time it does it again is when they're having those like abuse flashbacks of the abuse Wilkinson. Flashbacks. And it, yep. it makes those, I'm glad they did that for those flashbacks. And then we've already been introduced this technique and I'm like, okay, cool. I get why they did that. And yeah, you're right. Like the camera is moving, but everything's kind of shot from like a low angle and there's usually only yeah. one or two people in the frame at once. But yeah, you know, tough scene, tough resolution to the scene. They throw these poor kids. These are teenagers. I mean, they're throwing them in solitary confinement. There's rats everywhere. And then they do pay a huge price for the game. I mean, Rizzo is killed. And then I just want to say, this is a point of, I just want to call out that the bruising they have on their face in the hospital, the yellow bruising, is so scarily accurate. I never see movies get that right, that just before your bruise heals, especially a big face bruise, it turns that like yellow puke green color. It's very strange. But so basically that insinuates that they've been down there in solitary or in the hospital for a long time, because it takes a long time for a wound like that to heal. And they're not done. They have that really heartbreaking scene where the four of them talk about how they're never going to talk about this again. They're just going to bury it as deep as it goes. And I'm going to bring this up later, but I think that's true. I don't think any four of these guys have ever talked about this, even though they're hanging out. I think it has been buried. I think the first time all of this is brought up again is when John goes and sits at that bar next to Billy Crudup and says, "Look over there." I think that's the first time. Noakes has been mentioned, Wilkinson, all of it. So it's been buried. And
yeah, I don't think that that those two, because obviously like they're the ones who have stayed in touch because they're the killers. I do not think that they have talked about that. I don't think that's something that they commiserate about. I don't think that's certainly nothing that they have talked about healthily in a way to like, hey, let's be there for each other. Maybe in a way that Patrick and Pitt's characters kind of allude to that. Like maybe I'll need a friend. I don't think the other two did that. And I think you're right. Like as soon as they see Noakes, it's you're the only person I can say this to. Go over there and look who that is. But and that's why they both just know what needs to happen next.
Yeah. And the final scene in Wilkinson is it's so disturbing how like you're back in the hallway because it's, you know, it shakes his last night. And these guards are just like arguing about fucking work and their bosses. And it's like, it's so evil. Like it is nothing. Oh my God. Just small talk on our way to like horrific abuse. Oh my God. It's terrible.
It's really tragic that those kids like have that reaction as they're all together at that young age saying that I don't think we should ever talk about this. We should bury it because of just like, no matter who you are, like that's how you feel in that moment. But like, that's just going to build up and become such a, like, therapy can't even begin to kind of, like, that scene shown in 1996, you show that to someone now, and with what we've discovered about mental health and, like, the differences of the time, it's really interesting to kind of see how, would that be handled differently today? Would that, like, would there be a dialogue more open now? Interesting thought.
When I get out, I could get Father Bobby to make a couple phone calls, huh? Shave a month or two off.
There's nothing to talk about.
There's a lot to talk about. Maybe if people knew what was going on in here, they'd make a move.
I don't want anybody to know. Not Father Bobby, King Benny, Fat Mancho, not my mother. Nobody.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, I wouldn't know what to say to anyone who did know.
I can't think of anybody who needs to hear about it. I mean, either they won't believe it, or they won't give a shit.
Yeah, I don't even think we should talk about it once it's over, you know?
We got no choice but to live with it. And talking makes living it harder. So might as well not even talk about it. The truth stays with us.
I love this thread because that was something I thought about. That scene has always meant something to me, but it really hit this time knowing everything that we have such open dialogues about mental health. Even, you know, 1996 when this movie came out was when my brother was at his worst. No one was talking about mental health. It wasn't like these terms weren't around. Like no one was talking about this stuff and no one, these four young kids clearly don't have the perspective to know what can happen if you bury this, because that very wisely, the movie does something that, I don't know, I just feel like, I'm not saying movies don't jump ahead in the past, but a lot of movies now, everything's just jumping around constantly, and we're like, back and present, but this is just one hard jump, and it really hits, just like Place Beyond the Pines. Like, when that thing comes on screen, it's like 15 years later, you're like, what? What?
What?
So when this, yeah. So when this goes, you know, slow-mo, and then we're in fall 1981, I love everything about the sequence. Meeting adult John and Tom, they're walking in slow motion through that steam.
Yep.
They just sit down at the bar. You know, if you haven't seen the movie, you're not entirely positive which two of these kids it is yet. But, you know, this is just one of my favorite scenes just to watch. Like, I love this. I love just the murder of Sean Noakes, this set piece. I love this set piece so much. I love that. I love when they sit down. You know, John and Tom are clearly regulars. And they hear the guys talking. And they're like, you tell them that Republicans are not welcome in Hell's Kitchen. I love that. Either a political conversion or a change of conversation is necessary.
Is in order.
Is in order, yeah. So then John walks off, you know, he's got to take a leak. And that fucking double take he does, it goes slow motion. He does a double take where he just looks left and you hear the light come back. And then you just see this like pathetic, he looks like a rat now, like this pathetic man just like hunched over, drinking his beer, eating meatloaf and in some what are those people called, like guard money, in a uniform like that. Ron Eldred is John, just like staring at him, and I love, you know, can I help you with something, chief? And not right now. Like, I love his voice. He's probably like on drugs and just like coked out of his mind and drunk, and you know, we haven't seen this stuff, but we know that they abuse drugs. And then God, he just goes in that bathroom and is washing the face and taking that beat and that song, you know, queuing up. Da, 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 da. It's, I love this.
Can I help you with something, chief?
Not right now. Enjoy the rest of your meal.
I think this is the most well done sequence of the whole entire movie. And that's saying a lot, because I think there's a lot of really well done scenes. We've talked about a lot of them already. But I think just like it almost could almost work as a short film on its own.
Yeah.
Like in some ways, like even though we know what this history is, like there's so much of.
But they even say the history, even if it was a short film.
Yeah.
The two guys even like, oh, I thought you just liked blank blank little boys. Yeah, like it, you're right.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
like
could
a
you
perfect
yeah.
standalone set piece. Yeah,
it's yeah, you actually could, because like you then get reveal that information.
Yeah,
through that's interesting. But I, you know what is, I wondered again, this is just the way that I took it, but when he's in the bathroom and he's looking at himself in the mirror, there's at one point where he gets like a smile.
Mm-hmm.
and I was like, oh, he knows he's going to kill him right
now.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
And this
and he's
is
so happy.
The revenge. And he's like, thank God that this, we wandered into this bar and this guy's here, because now we can do this.
Yeah. Like, now my life has purpose. It's like what I've always wanted, to watch you die. Like, yeah, he's happy.
Yeah.
He's happy. Yeah.
Oh, my God,
it's
man.
It's such a great choice. It's so great that he lets him just have that moment in the mirror. Like, oh, my God. Yeah.
And it's a complete switch from like in those moments where we see Jason Patrick having those flashbacks and it's of pain and all this and that. It would be so easy for that actor to go into that bathroom and feel the same thing, like it, like have those flashbacks for himself and just get into a place of like, oh, revenge, revenge. But he got into a like sublime state.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Oh. Just really, really great shit right here, man. Good shit.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is my favorite staged scene of the movie, because we know The entire geography of the bar in this, we know where everyone's located.
Yep.
Even the quote unquote insignificant shot of Ida Totoro sitting there drinking her wine a little too loosely, like, which is going to come up later, you know, her.
Yep.
Oh, God. And then, yeah, Eldred is just, well, no, first they go back to Billy Crudup, and even Crudup plays it a little different. Crudup's like, you know, he goes, take a good look, and he just looks, and he's like more, there's no smiles. He's like, motherfucker. Like, he's almost in shock. Like, I can't believe this. And there's no need to communicate this. There's no need to communicate, well, I guess dinner's canceled. Let's go over and shoot this guy to fucking bits. It's just, it's like, they get up, they walk over. I love, and they're staring at him, you know? I love that shot of them at the top of the stairs, loading their guns, tucking their guns. And the way they just turn that corner, like, Ron Eldred, if you've seen, like, Scent of a Woman, Drop Dead Fred, it's not like an intimidating guy. I'm fucking terrified of these two in this sequence.
Yeah.
Just, they got those like gloves on where their fingers are exposed. And I just love it. They go sit to stand there and he's talking to him like he's talking to Noakes like he's old. He goes, hello, been a long time. I just love that. And he's like, what the hell? Oh, God. So yeah, they sit down and they have it out. They have this little conversation. And I love when they lay everything out and, you know, take a minute, it'll come to you. And Bacon's response processing all this is simply, it was a long time ago. And he just nods. So how you been? Oh, man. It's like, it's just everything for me. And you know, like, oh, this is how you're responding to it. Okay, this is not going to be like a difficult decision for me to make as Jonatom. Great scene.
Yeah, great scene. It's amazing. It's so good. And it's also kind of like crazy to think too, like this was probably the very first time this has ever encountered, because now this, he's been doing this for so long that now people have had a chance to grow up. And it's like, bet you didn't think about that, did you? Like,
yeah, exactly. You definitely did not think about the ramifications of your horrific abuse.
Yes, yes.
This is amazing. Hello, it's been a long time.
Who the fuck are you guys?
Hey.
Who the fuck asked you to sit down?
I thought you'd be happy to see us. I guess I was wrong.
You know, I thought you'd do a lot better, you know? You know, with all that training, all that time you put in, just to end up watching someone else's money, that seems like a waste.
I'm asking now for the last time, what the fuck do you want?
Why don't you take your time? It'll come to you. I could see how you might forget us.
Yeah.
You know, we were just something for you and your friends to play with.
It's a little harder for us to forget. You gave us so much more to remember.
Can't quite place us, can you, Chief? Let me help you out. You're looking at John Riley and Tommy Marcano.
And then I love when they pay for their meals and leave. And it just, it's great. It's so good. We cut to Jason Patrick, you know, walking all seriously down the hallway. Now we're getting to meet adult Shakes. And I, you know, he sits down with Jonatom. They're so excited. They're like, one down, Shakes, one down. I love that. And again,
yeah,
it's probably one Sean Noakes. This is probably the first time they've said that name to each other in the 15 years that have passed. And, you know, it doesn't sound like Jason Patrick as Shakes has been dealing with this a lot. Again, he's just trying to like survive. Then he goes in the middle of Queens, or he goes to Queens in the middle of the night to meet with Brad Pitt, who's the adult Michael. It's just great setup. I love this setup so much. I love that as Pitt gets going, he's like cruising. Patrick just interrupts him. He's like, how long have you been working on this, Michael? And Pitt just blows past it, keeps going. But the setup's fairly simple-ish. Michael's a lawyer, and he is to take the case for the city. He is going to prosecute John and Tom in the murder of Sean Noakes, but he is secretly taking the case to lose so that he can set his guys free and hopefully expose Wilkinson in the process. If all goes according to plan, everyone wins. And they're just going through each person. I love that Ralph Ferguson, he's like, well, he seems clean, right? And he goes, yeah, that's exactly what I want, the piece of shit.
Yeah.
But here the movie's really starting to change into like bit more of like All the President's Men vibe. You know, they got the writing Edmund in the top section of the metro, the top corner of the metro section. Like, I just love that, all that little shit. It's a good setup. I mean, it's going to be tough to pull off, but I also love that presumably the only reason Michael has become a lawyer was to be able to get access to like all these files and just take these guys down. Because as soon as his case is done, he's gone. He moves to a different country and spends the rest of his life alone.
Oh, man.
Boys. Ralph Ferguson works in a social service agency in Long Island.
How long have you been working on this, Mike?
He's recently divorced, got one child, and on weekends teaches Catholic Sunday school.
Seems clean then, right?
That's exactly why I want the piece of shit. The plan is to call Ferguson in as a character witness, get him talking about his best friend Sean Noakes. Once I got him on the stand, I'm going to open the door to Wilkins.
We get to meet Danny Snyder, who, you know, he's been brought on as their lawyer, and they're like, oh, we'll get it changed. And Pitts goes, no, he's perfect. I, again, love so much that a guy who won an Oscar for a Barry Levinson movie is coming in as like the eighth lead and just kills it. I love this performance.
It's so subtle too. Like sometimes he's just mumbling over his lines and he's speaking them so low. He's like, "Do you want to?" How long did this take? And it's very Dustin Hoffman like, but like almost like done like for a reason. Is like this guy is just a loser of a dude.
Just like a Hell's Kitchen shitty ambulance chasing lawyer. He's an admitted alcoholic. He had four cases last year. He lost them all, and he's essentially told by King Benny, oh, you know, you have nothing to lose, just like the rest of us. So essentially, if you mess this up, we'll just kill you, but it's no big deal. Like, you know, you have nothing to lose, because you're going to be given the questions and the answers. All you have to do is be sober, show up,
and read.
Just the fumbling and the strike that tread, constantly flipping that notepad over and over, like running into the desk. I love we're constantly getting like the peanut gallery commentary during the trial from Minnie Driver and Jason Patrick, usually about Danny Snyder's poor performance. They're just always like,
yep,
it's so good. It's like pulling teeth. It's so good. I love catching up with his dad, Bruno Kirby, at dinner. And you're like, this dude cannot discuss anything beyond trivial small talk. How's work? How's the food? You think this is the guy that Shakes can go to about his abuse? Like, of course not. He's not going to.
No.
What the hell would he even say to that? He probably just wouldn't even talk. Where's the chicken? That's all he's concerned about.
Yep.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's that unfortunate reality to that closed off.
But I love that they ground us in that, that they show us that, like, they state that the mom is still there. How much abuse has that woman taken?
Are you kidding?
And she loves Shake so much, you can tell.
Yep.
Oh,
the way that the community comes back into this movie is so cool.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Like,
yeah.
It really makes you know, like, that's just how it is. Like, and I think that's almost why I have such a big, like, push-pull with the kids and the adults, because the community stays the same. All those actors are the same, you know. It's just now these groups, but I just never felt like the adults fit back in the way that the kids do. But that's the point, also, too, because they can't. Like what's happened to them is just like it's not the same.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not. But with the Wilkinson, with our trip to purgatory there, with the colder, like, temperature of the film, there's no pop music playing. There's no one from the neighborhood except Father Bobby showing up. Yeah, you feel all that. And when we're back with them, even though it's years later, it's like, okay, everyone's doing, like, kind of okay. Like, it's okay. It's good. And everyone's going to be in on this grift. Everyone knows it. That's not really talked about that much, but King Benny knows the deal. Fat Man knows the deal. Yep. Everyone's got their part to play. And that's what I like about it.
Ugh.
Speaking of Father Bobby, we're meeting him as an adult now. And after a particularly horrible flashback that Shakes has, he goes to Father Bobby's house with Carol, with Minnie Driver. And this is one of the anchor scenes of the movie. Like, talked about some really good set pieces that have happened, but this is one of the scenes in the movie that grounds the movie in what is really happening. So let's stop with, like, the funny zingers and the scam and, like, all this, you know, cloak and dagger stuff. This is when all is revealed, as Shakes tells the story of the abuse that they all endured at Wilkinson. It's a tough scene. It is tougher if you watch the film with subtitles on. Again, going back to the restraint of the movie, let's just assume that whole speech lasted 30 minutes, an hour. And I'm sure Shakes got as horrifically graphic as he needed to. I'm sure he was telling the truth, or like, and what we hear are, it's tough to hear, but it is, it's restrained speaking. It just is, because we know how much worse this all was. And then at some point, Levinson just makes the extremely bold and wise decision to finish this scene by just holding on Robert De Niro's face for like 45 seconds as he hears this horrific stuff. And when, you know, when we're watching it, we're like, man, De Niro, goddamn, he can just do it. He can do it. But already what's spinning in his head is, this picture is being painted for me because I'm going to have to potentially go against God in order to help here. And I mean, it's a great way to end that scene. You're like, when is it going to cut from him? I love this whole sequence in particular. Love the way Minnie Driver plays it, how she's just quiet and standing there. Really good scene.
No, yeah, it's the hold on De Niro that's just so, like, you could have shot that scene in so many ways. So many ways that would have all been impactful. But, and if you notice too, like, De Niro in that moment, he's not super expressive. It's not like,
just like a priest. Yeah. It's not, his face is not really changing that much. It's more like this, his job is to listen right now.
And it's almost like, because we're hearing what these words are too, it is sort of like that we get to kind of paint whatever we want as an audience on his face. If he's doing too much, then we're being told what he's thinking. But the way he does it, by just listening and taking it in, we get to kind of like wonder, like, what is he feeling or what am I feeling? It's a great, great choice.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. The courtroom scenes are fun. They move really well. There's really three standout scenes. I've broken them out. The first one is Mrs. Salinas. I love how Hoffman just keeps calling her that. And, you know, the back half of this movie, this plot does largely play out as a courtroom thriller. It has a lot of the same conventions of the courtroom thriller, but I just love the way that Dustin Hoffman tricks her and catches her with her words. You glanced, Miss Salinas, you glanced. And then when he puts together all the alcohol that she, and, you know, the shock of the gunfire, and I really love that. Oh, I forgot to mention, that gunfire is so accurate in that restaurant. I don't know how they did it, but it sounds like they actually took like a real gun with blanks, of course, down to that restaurant and fired them off, because it doesn't sound muffled. They sound so real, like you jump when you see them. Some gunshots they're not effective because of the sound design. And I love that comes back up. Like, have you ever heard a gun go off? No. He takes her apart, and I love it. I love it.
Yeah, by stumbling through everything.
Yeah, by just flipping the papers. Where did you And as you know, as the sleepers are working, we get to see Jason Patrick Shakes is burying Styler in the back of that cop car, giving all the evidence over to Eternal Affairs. And then I love that scene of Brad Pitt and Minnie Driver on the train.
Oh,
and he's
like
sitting behind her. Tell him to explain all the abuse to Father Bobby. And then she admits that she knows. And I mean, you see that, because we've gathered backstory that these were once like great loves. Michael and Carol like were in love, and even she gives him a hug at the end in that restaurant, and it's such a meaningful hug, and he can't even look at her. He can't even look her in the eye because of the stuff that's his cross to bear. Michael has kept himself busy. He's kept himself busy with active work of taking these guys down, but I don't think he's once done any sort of work internally on himself.
None.
And Pitt plays that really well.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, especially when he just disappears from it, because she even says in one part where she's like, Michael and I could have worked but it was just this wall. And she goes, I just couldn't break it down. So when he leaves, he's like, yeah, that dude hasn't changed.
Yeah. Yeah. The wall's still up. But with Styler going down, we get to see him being dragged away in a cop car. And then we get a great scene with Little Caesar, played by Wendell Pierce. It's Bunk from The Wire and King Benny. I love this. It's just like two old school dudes with a lot of respect for each other. And you're on your side of the battlefield. I'm on mine. We keep everything. Everything's cool. But then, because King Benny has acquired Addison's debt to Little Caesar, he just, King Benny offers him right up. And that's a great death scene, just blasting him under the plane like that so you can't hear it. Ugh, it's so good.
It's another very Goodfellas moment right there, I thought.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was just like, thank God Wayne and Garth aren't at that airport under the plane the planes go by. But yeah, very like Goodfellas. We're out in the city, like boom, boom. Oh, it's great. You got the boss in the car just lighting his cigar. With the guards going down, one down, now two, now three, that leaves us with Ralph Ferguson, and that opens us up to courtroom scene two. This is an extremely difficult scene to watch. It's one of my favorites in the movie. With Ferguson left to be buried, and he seems to have changed his life a little bit, we see this sad sack piece of shit walk into the courtroom, and he intends to justify to the strength of Sean Noakes' character.
Yep.
So already, he's lying, because this motherfucker is not a guy who's worth defending. I love when he realizes what's happening and finally admits the truth. You know, I believe when he looks down at John and Tom and they've changed to the little boys, that's when Ferguson gets it. I think it clicks for him.
Yep.
I think he hears the noise coming back, that light, the chain against that light bulb. It's just a huge scene for, like, at the time, a really not very well-known character actor coming in and crushing it. And
crushing
I mean, he's perfect. The way he eases out that yes, and everyone's like, even Brad Pitt's like, wait, huh? And Dustin Hoffman's like, yes, yes. And, Fat Man has a line where he's talking about Danny Snyder, Dustin Hoffman. He goes, he is a drunk, but he is not a fool. This is when you see it. This is when you see him, you know, just the little things he like eases out. Was torture part of the job? You know, and just the easing out that stuff. It's brilliant. And instead of him kind of tripping Mrs. Salinas' words against her, Ralph Ferguson just breaks on the stand. And he and Danny Snyder is the one there to brilliantly catch it.
Boys were tortured, weren't they, Mr. Ferguson?
Define torture.
Well, let's define torture. Cigarette burning, random beatings, solitary confinement with no food and no light. Say that took place?
On occasion.
Who tortured them?
Guards.
Which guards?
I can't remember all of them.
Remember one.
It's a very, very fascinating observation on someone that, you know, like we see when Noakes was presented with those boys being right in front of them, that he just took a whole entire, like, double down and emotion, yep. careless. Just being like, yeah, well, I was trying to do this with you boys and all this and this. But this is another human being that did these things, but his reaction was very different where, who knows? Like, because I'm sure he's probably never told anyone about what he had done. So now that he's here, because it all comes out of him like a waterfall. Like, as soon as that dam breaks, he just confesses everything. And it's hard with each question, but he's not putting up a front about it. And I think that's a very real moment. I think that's a very it works in a lot of ways because, well, the script and story dictate that we need him to do this. But how do you, as an actor, on the page, I just come clean. I'm not even here for this. I'm here I'm just here to defend Noakes and defend his character. But all of a sudden now that this is what was going on, like that's the choice of the actor is like, I have almost in a way, like I have been waiting for someone to get this out of me. Like I need to like purge my soul of all of this. And that's what it almost looks like is each thing is he's crying. He's just more and more. And then, you know, unfortunately for him, well, fortunately for justice, the judge is like, so Mr. Ferguson, don't go.
Don't go too far.
There's going to be people who need to talk to you.
You understand? Yeah. Like his life is, as he knows it, is done. But yeah, he lets out that first yes, which seems unprompted, and it kind of startles everyone. And then he just keeps answering yes to these questions that are more and more horrible. And at one point, Hoffman even says, like, you know, boys were abused, and he's something like more than once.
Yeah.
And the look, and Terry Kennedy's like, looks like, way more than once. Like, And oh, God, he has that perfect line. He goes, I was drinking then, and just throws that like, God, I was a fucking drunk then. And you can, that's what it is. It's almost like, I don't know, I'm not trying to look too much into this, but if he says that, maybe this dude is in some sort of like recovery program. You're looking at step 9, making amends. Here you go, buddy. Even if it means you got to go to prison for the rest of your life. But yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like the way that he does that, it doesn't come off unrealistic. It comes off as a way of like, oh, wow, like there's something going on with this guy so that when this starts coming out, like that's how this is happening. That's a very challenging scene, I think, for an actor right there. Like you don't have much to go on, but yet you need to just let the world out.
And I love like when people are in these situations, just asking an extremely like basic, somewhat like just an obvious question. Like, okay, if this guy was your best friend, would you trust him alone with your children?
Mm-hmm.
Was Sean Noakes a good babysitter? And he's like, oh, there would never be a reason for that to come up. It's like, yeah, there could be a reason for your best friend to babysit your kids, but I just love that. And the look on his face, like, no, that would never. Of course you wouldn't ask him to watch your kids. You know what he's capable of.
Yeah.
Ugh. So Ferguson goes down. I mean, fuck you, buddy.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Yeah, there are. I love. Of course, there's a little levity in it when Brad Pitt, they call him up to the, you know, the judge's table. And he's like, what's going on? He's like, I don't know. I guess I called the wrong character witness.
I love that.
It's like, yeah, I think so. And then our last big courtroom scene is devastating to watch him do it. But Father Bobby gets up there and De Niro really makes you feel the conflict he had at arriving here. I mean, you know, he's gone absent. Like, this guy's pulled a Claude Rains. Nobody's seen him. We don't know, like, where he is. There's this whole scam. There's ticket stubs involved. But moreover, you're asking a man who's dedicated his life to God to betray that as he sees it. What I love most about this scene is that once he starts going, he delivers his answer so well because he's been thinking about this constantly.
Yeah.
He's been running it through. He's been going through this scenario over and over, and he's prepared. So that's why there's no like hesitation. And I love how shocked John looks at the table. He's like, what the hell? Like, oh my God, he's doing this for us. Pitt looks down almost ashamed because he knows, you know, what he's asked. And that final, when he looks at him, he goes, thank you, Father. Like there's so much in there. It's not that it's thank you on so many different. It's so layered. It's a very, very layered thank you. And, you know,
yeah.
I do also think it's interesting that we find out what happens to all the major people involved in this movie. We don't find out what happens to Father Bobby. It just says
that's what I mean. Yeah.
Shake says he never recovered from seeing him lie for us. I mean, I hope he stayed as a priest. I hope he cut himself a break because I don't know. I'm glad he did it. That's all I can say.
Well, I mean,
But then it's just going to open up so many other conversations because John and Tom, they do get off in this case. But where does their life go? What is it all for?
Did that matter? I mean, I guess you could chalk it up to like, they didn't change their direction in life, but in that moment, maybe this was the right thing to do. But yeah, but then all for what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. De Niro's great in that scene, though. Ugh.
It very much to me seems like he's done whatever prepper, not as De Niro as the actor, but as Father Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
When he looks down at that Bible and puts his hand on it, it's like he's already like, he's like, yep, I knew this. I knew when I was going to have to do this, and I'm about to lie. Yep. To me, right now, this isn't the Bible. Like,
yeah.
It's almost kind of what it feels like. Yep, I see this. I've already had this discussion with myself. It's not what it is. Like, whatever you need to do to forget that you're about to betray your word of God. That's such a good scene. He's so good. Oh, De Niro.
Yeah, he really is. I mean, he really makes me feel the conviction of a priest, which is not as... This is what we say is that some things like transcend film because I'm just personally not a very religious person, but I care so much about his faith.
Yes.
Like I really do. I really care about it. And that's a tough thing to pull off.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, you know, like when you really sense the man's conviction, like it's almost like Winter Light, you know,
rounding
this back here, like all I care about is that man's faith, you know,
and how
it's been shaken. Like that's all I care about. So in this one, it's a similar thing, but I'm like, oh my God, please don't let this lose. Like, don't lose your faith to like, yeah. So that is something when a priest character can make you feel the love for their faith.
Oh, my absolute favorite scene of the movie we're coming. I mean, it's like basically the rest of the movie, but if I had to pick just one thing,
this would be it. This would be the one scene
when Michael and Shakes are talking. Yeah. Outside when Michael and Shakes are, and I already said, you know, I may need a good friend though. Find you when you do, you can count on it. I just love all the, there's so much resignation within Brad Pitt of like, I've seen all the law I want to see. Like, yeah. This is it. I'm done. I'm packing it up. He's been so laser focused on one thing, and now that it's done, what do you do?
It's time for quiet, Shakes. I just want to shut my eyes and not have to see the places I've been. I'm weary. I don't know. Maybe I'll get lucky, forget I was even there.
Well, don't disappear on me, counselor. I may need a good lawyer one day.
Hey, you can't afford a good lawyer.
Okay. I may need a good friend, though.
I'll find you when you do. Count on.
And I love that in their very final meeting, we're told that everyone has reverted back to normal. So despite them winning this case and burying the four guards, life goes on. Carol and Shakes, they go back to work. Tom and John, they go back to the street. Michael resigns. And then with this meeting, I love Ron Elder just coming in. And he's so big and boisterous. He's like, you know, when I first heard he was taking a case, I was going to have it burned. It's like, because they never told him that Brad Pitt was in on it, but I just love that so much. And the way that, like, Minnie Driver and Brad Pitt hug, and I already mentioned that, but you feel all the love there, and that when they separate, he can't even look at her. He's just, you know, let's get a drink. And this is, I mean, it's just such a good scene. The circular table and singing Walk Like a Man for Carol, and then that brilliant coda of brilliant and tragic that within a few years, John and Tom are dead from the street. Shakes has gotten a promotion at work. Carol has a child. And that leaves Michael, who we're told has moved to the English countryside, works part time as a carpenter, and lives quietly and alone. And if you go all the way back to episode 13 of What Are You Watching? Place Beyond the Pines, I dedicated my What Are You Watching segment to Sleepers and that line. He lives quietly and alone. And as I was growing up and as I was becoming a young filmmaker, that was the person I wanted to know. I wanted to know the person who survived all this awful stuff and then had decided to isolate themselves. If you go look at some of the work I've made, like that's so much. It's just in there. It's just right there. And that's, you know, that's why I love Good Will Hunting so much, because I do think we're finding him. Good Will Hunting basically takes place like if it was 5 years later instead of 15 years later of Sleepers. You know, he's received all this horrible abuse, has not even begun to process it, and has just weaponized it. And, you know, no one can fuck with me. Like, I'll beat anyone who reminds me of someone I went to kindergarten with. But I love this final meeting in Sleepers. It's so good. And the ending, the resolution of all the characters is very accurate. It's not like John went on to be a fucking senator, you know? This is not that movie.
It's the Replacements ending, you know? It's just kind of sad.
Exactly. Everyone goes back to life. It's exactly like the Replacements. That's exactly what it reminds me of.
I love endings like this, though, because like they're not the Hollywood ending, but they're the real ending. No. And it really kind of, you get introspective about it.
On March 16th, 1984, John Riley's bloated body was found face up in a tenement building, right next to the bottle of boiler gin that killed him. At the time of his death, he was a suspect in 5 unsolved homicides. He was 2 weeks past his 29th birthday. Thomas Marcano died on July 26, 1985, He was shot at close range 5 times. The body lay undiscovered for more than a week. There was a crucifix and a picture of St. Jude in his pocket. He was 29 years old. Michael Sullivan lives in a small town in the English countryside where he works part-time as a carpenter. He no longer practices law, and he is never married. He lives quietly and alone.
That's it. That's our movie. I love this movie. I'm so glad we got to talk about it. I mentioned these people along the way, but Michael Ballhouse, he was a cinematographer. He did so many movies for Rainer Werner Fassbinder. That was in Germany and then came over to America, did a ton for Marty, After Hours, Color Money, Last Temptation of Christ, Goodfellas, The Departed. He did Bram Stoker's Dracula, which looks amazing, shot Air Force One, great film.
Yes.
He was nominated for Oscars for Broadcast News, a movie that I need to rewatch. I have not rewatched that in years, and I just need to rewatch Broadcast News, The Fabulous Baker Boys, and Gangs of New York. The movie was edited by Stu Linder. He's collaborated with Barry Levinson a lot. He was nominated for, actually, he won an Oscar for Best Editing in 1966 for the film Grand Prix, directed by John Frankenheimer. Sleepers received one Oscar nomination in 1996, and that was for the music by the great John Williams. Is this man never not nominated? He lost this year to Gabriel Yared for The English Patient. That was The English Patient's year. Just real quick, John Williams. This was his 35th Oscar nomination. He has been nominated 54 times. He has won 5. I don't know if I've ever said him. Thought it'd be fun to say him. 1971, his first Oscar, Best Original Score, Fiddler on the Roof. 1975, Jaws. 1977, Star Wars. 1982, E.T. And the last time John Williams won an Oscar was in 1993, the Best Original Score for Schindler's List. So that man gets invited to the party a lot since 1993 and does not win. He's going to be there this year, or at least he's been nominated. I had one, you know, kind of a prompt here. Just one acting Oscar from Sleepers can win. Who wins it?
It's Kevin Bacon.
It's Kevin Bacon. It has to be. He got a lot of praise. Dustin Hoffman actually got a lot of praise for like a supporting part. De Niro did too. I don't know what the hell happened here. This was the year of Fargo, which was like the big indie movie. I don't know if they didn't market this or distribute this enough. I lost sight of like where this was in the Oscar conversation. I don't know, but
it's crazy that it only got one nomination for music. Like there's so many. It's wild.
I mean, yeah, cinematography, it could have gotten in there, a screenplay, but also just someone for maybe all the actors canceled themselves out. I don't know. But Bacon. Yeah, I would have loved that. And this is also, I don't know how fashionable this game is anymore, but when we were kids, 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon was like a thing. It was a huge game that people would play. And the two biggest movies I always had in my back pocket that no one ever remembered was Sleepers, which has so many
people.
Which
is everybody.
And Apollo 13. Yeah. Apollo 13 has everyone. He made those back to back. So if you can, it's very easy to do 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon when you can remember Apollo 13 and Sleepers. Boom. That's a little tip there.
Little tip. Even Dash Mihook is, you can love throw him in there.
Damn right you can. And then you're right in the Thin Red Line and everyone's in that.
And then everyone's so in there.
Oh God, I love it. I was a fucking king of 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon in middle school and high school, pre-internet. I would crush it. People would be like, I bet you can't do this one. And I'd do it in like one jump. All the time. And you know what I would end on? Sleepers. They're like, what's that? I'm like, yeah. What are you watching? We've arrived. This is a fun episode. I know we got serious there early on. Appreciate everyone listening. Appreciate you being on board. I wouldn't be able to do this unless you were like, you know, giving me your love and your energy. I feel your look and it feels good. And everything's all good. We're here. You made it. Go watch Sleepers. Tell me about a movie that means a lot to you for whatever reason. I don't care. I love talking about this shit.
Well, speaking of movies that mean a lot to me, you gave a prompt for this that I'll put out loud. because
okay.
that you were like, you can pick anything, but I'd honestly love to know about a tough movie that helped you emotionally. Yeah. There's actually a couple, and this is crazy, like that I always kind of like gravitate towards Leo, because Ooh. two of my biggest movies growing up that were very tough but helped me emotionally were, and I already referenced one on a What Are You Watching recommendation, that was This Boy's Life.
Ugh.
And the second one I'm going to do is Basketball Diaries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be my recommendation, because that was a movie where, you know, like drugs were close to the family. And my mom was just very like she like I was a good kid. But my mom, I think she went out of her way to make sure that I didn't end up in that type of world or that type of life.
Same.
So,
yeah.
She showed me Basketball Diaries right around the time it came out on video.
So you would have been like 10, 9 or 10.
9 or 10.
I just want to say, I think this is fantastic parenting. And I'm not joking. My parents did the exact same thing to me. Yep. Oh, yes. I am dead serious. Yes.
And she goes, I want you to watch this. And I want you to watch it not just as a movie, but I want you to watch this is almost a cautionary tale of sorts. And she told me, she goes, when it got to that end argument, that end fight where Leo is trying to ask his mom for money. When he's outside the door.
Ugh.
My mom was like, if you ever do anything like this to me, like this would be the ultimate worst thing you could ever do as like a son to me is to be do this. So like when I saw this scene, I was like, okay, like I was not doing drugs. Drugs weren't even on the radar, but I was like, I never want to end up like this. I never want my life to go in a direction where this could be a reality for my mom. And weirdly, I watched that movie all the time, and it was not
you're
comfortable.
Describing my sleepers,
it was just a very, very real moment that I think meant more for my mom. I think it was more like I need to do what I need to do so this doesn't happen to me. But me being a 9-10-year-old kid taking in Basketball Diaries, I was like, oh my God, I'm terrified. I don't want any part of this. So it worked really, really well. And subsequently, I've never put my mother in that position. So
good.
but it's good. Also a really fucking good movie. And it's like one of Leo's best performances. And Bruno Kirby is in this one, too.
Good call. He is.
In
as
another,
a bit of a creeper.
A little bit more.
A big creeper. Young Mark Wahlberg is in this. He's very, very good. And then the earlier recommendation, This Boy's Life, is De Niro.
Yes,
and this
De Niro.
Is a complete opposite of Father Bobby. This is one of his most, I mean, I'm not like making a joke or bringing this up. Like Max Cady in Cape Fear is like a psycho. Yeah, but that's so obvious. This Boy's Life is like this dude gets along in society, but he is a fucking monster.
Yeah,
that's a great. I don't think a lot of people have seen that one. Maybe a few more have seen Basketball Diaries, but people definitely got to check these out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, This Boy's Life is just a really, really, for me, it was tough because like being with a single mom, that was like the fear. That like we would end up in a family situation with a guy like this. And Leo is just so good in it. Like and plays off De Niro, and Ellen Barkin is such a great, because she's such a strong female for a little bit, but then loses it because of just this man. And then, it's a great movie. Both of them are really good, but very hard hitting.
Very hard hitting. Those are good. A good double feature, tough double feature, but a good one.
I don't know if I do a double feature, but
well, I would.
Yeah, you would.
So, that's why I'm me. Mine, I've talked about this movie before. I already referenced it in this episode, but it is Denzel Washington's first movie as a director, Antoine Fisher. I've brought this up so many times. We will have to do an episode on it, and this episode will have to include my dad, and it'll be, you know, the three of us, and it'll just be... It'll be great. It'll be nice, and, you know, we'll probably get serious about some stuff, because this is this movie helped me in ways that I think I talked about all the way back in episode 5, our most memorable movie going experiences, but which I'm not going to rehash now. But yeah, it helped me in so many ways, as much, if not even more, than Sleepers did. And then I didn't even know everything that was going on with my dad at the time, and it helped him too. Our family dynamic looked nothing like Antoine Fisher's in real life or in the movie, but that didn't matter because what I'm talking about transcends all that. I've never been to like a school for boys. This stuff doesn't matter. We're talking about like really cutting through. So that movie will come up someday. I don't know when, but that's another one that if you've seen it and you're like, oh yeah, that was a good movie. I cried. Yeah, good. That movie, man, that movie changed my life for the better, all for the better. I'm so indebted to it. Thank you, Denzel Washington. Love Denzel, obviously.
Fucking Denzel.
This is great. So happy to finally talk about Barry Levinson, talk about one of his movies, our favorite Barry Levinson. I had no idea Sleepers was your favorite. Let us know what you think about Sleepers. Go check it out if you haven't seen it. On Twitter, Instagram, we're out there. Letterboxd at WAYW_podcast. But as always, thanks for listening and happy watching. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. You can watch my films and read my movie blog at alexwithrow.com. NicholasDostal.com is where you can find all of Nick's film work. Send us mailbag questions at whatareyouwatchingpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at WAYW_podcast. Thanks again for tuning into this episode. It does mean a lot to me. Next time, we're going to do one of the things we love most, which is argue about who is going to be winning Academy Awards. The ceremony is on Sunday, March 10th. We're going to predict every category, talk about all the most up-to-date narratives. Is it Oppenheimer's year? Here we go. Stay tuned.